And also the NPA amendment bill. We are here as a joint of two committees of NA, that is the Committee on Safety and Security and the Committee on Justice. Ours is to listen to what the public and everybody is saying as far as this piece of legislation is concerned. As you are aware that the bill which we are dealing with today is a proposal from the Cabinet on the relocation of the DSO, popularly known as the Scorpions. Therefore, we are here as Parliament to listen to what everybody will be saying. We appeal to people to fully participate in these hearings, and provincial public hearings will follow from the 11th up to the 15th of August. We invite you to actively monitor how we process this bill. We have nothing to hide. Everything will be in open, transparent committee meetings. People are free to continue to submit further written representation to us. We therefore say that even those that we received, we didn't receive much written submission from the public. So far, we have received 116, and of those 116, about 35 has indicated that they would like to make an oral presentation. The rest that we received are petitions, signed petitions, of which we are going to consider those, although they don't assist us at the moment as far as the process is concerned, because we would like to give those people an opportunity of coming to the public hearings, make their oral presentation, so that when we take a decision as Parliament, we take decision on an informed information from those individuals. I think we all do have programs in front of us. We will start by taking the overview of the proposed new integrated criminal justice system.
Can I just say a few introductory words as well. We'll come to members. Firstly, is to say that, as the co-chair said, these bills will be treated like all other bills before Parliament. These are the bills of Cabinet at the moment, of the Executive, and Parliament will exercise its full oversight role. We will treat every clause of this bill the way we treat clauses of bills generally. Just to add to what the chairperson has said, the aim is at the end of these hearings, both nationally and provincially, the hearings in the provinces will presumably end on Monday, the 18th of August, I think, if I'm right, Comrade Chair.
Yes.
The 18th will have done provincial public hearings here in the Western Cape. On the 19th, there are some people who are in the program but who are unable to attend this week, and we will accommodate them on Tuesday the 19th. But we will not, as usual, immediately launch into processing the clauses. We will do exactly what we do on every bill, so we would like to assure you, notwithstanding what has emerged in the press last week, which we must stress was a specific response to a very specific context. And we are urging people who have sent us petitions, that's fine, but we would like them to make specific concrete proposals on the bills before us. But just to indicate to you what we mean to do, we will do exactly what we've done. For example, on the Child Justice Bill, which the Justice Committee just processed, here is a summary of the contents of the Child Justice Bill. In other words, what we did was, with the research unit and the department, we have, at the beginning, all the policy issues raised in the public hearings. They run into something like 40-plus pages. And then here's the department's reply to the submissions we receive from the public. And that runs into something like 36 pages. Then what we will do is, when we look at the bills, at every clause, when we come to it, we will look at what the public has said about that specific clause and what the reply of the department is to that specific clause, and then we will engage with it. But before that, you will see, we can take examples of this we can give you. You can see where even people don't make specific amendments to specific clauses, they make general points about a bill, that comes up front, so we then respond to the general points. So we are urging people to understand, notwithstanding what has emerged from the press conference last week, that we will in fact give assiduous, complete attention to in fact the bills, and we ask you not to prejudge the process, and we ask you to engage with it, and we urge those of you who can to actually solicit people, actively mobilize people to come to the public hearings from Monday next. Finally, we want to stress that Deputy Minister Johnny De Langa and Director General Menzi Simelane will be dealing with right now. Cabinet, as you know, has appointed Deputy Minister Johnny De Langa to take responsibility for Cabinet as a whole to accelerate this process. Up till now, in fact, and this has come from pressure from the Justice Committee, as you will know, we have said to the Executive, it's not enough to shape a new model, a new system of criminal justice, solely through engagement with Business Against Crime and other stakeholders that the Cabinet engages with. What about the public? If the public is to have an active shaping of this new model from the very outset, the public will be more actively engaging around it and having ownership over it. So in short, we are just as keen to hear from people, not just in these public hearings in the National Assembly, but in the provinces, on what the public thinks about the new proposed integrated criminal justice system, within which ultimately the restructuring, if that is to be the case, of the Scorpions has to be located. So in short, these public hearings are not just about the bills, but about the new proposed policy of Cabinet on the criminal justice system. Thank you.
Chairperson, I want to ask a question on a point of clarity, please. Chairperson, I want to start to ask, because you just said that we must hear what the public is saying about this whole process, but you, Honourable Chair, is on television, national television, where you said it doesn't matter what the public say, the process and the Scorpions will be disbanded according to a decision taken at Polokwane. Now my question to you is, we are fooling the public, we are misleading them by telling them that we'd like to hear what they are saying about this, because you already took a decision. In fact, you're the vice chairperson. You said it yourself. So what is the use that we're going through this whole process? We're only doing window dressing to comply to the rules, but we're actually telling the public, yes, we can hear what you are saying, but we're not going to listen what you are saying. And I want to ask you, what is the viewpoint? And what is the use that we go through this whole process, wasting taxpayers' money? You're going to visit all the provinces. It's taxpayers' money that will have to bear the costs of that. So we're wasting the taxpayers' money as well. So what is the use going through this whole window dressing?
Thank you, Mr. Groeneveld, sir. Yes, sir.
Madam, I trust that for the rest of the proceedings you will watch out for hands that are raised. I have raised my hand immediately when we started, and you seem to have ignored me, but thank you for the opportunity. There's a maxim as old as our legal system itself. It starts, plus valet, quod agitur, goes on. It means, in broad terms, that the intention is more important than what is visible on the surface. And that is exactly what is happening here. This whole process, I'm sorry to say, is merely a farce. Because you have clearly indicated at the press conference, and I'll come back to that, at the press conference, that the decision to disband, or the decision to, as you have put it, absorb the Scorpions into SAPS, that has been taken. Now, surely, the whole basis for legislation, and the intention with that legislation is of cardinal importance. It goes to the whole essence of the legislation itself. And I am afraid that this whole process, the money we're going to spend, the visits, all of that, is just playing for the gallery, actually bluffing public. You are not sitting here with an open mind. You are not even, with all due respect, present the figures of the submissions. And I can prove that from what through my party has been sent in. You are not even presenting the figures of submissions correctly. So, from my party side, I want to strongly object, and I want to place it on record, and for public consumption, that I personally do not regard this as a proper and hearings in terms of what was intended when public hearings not only became the practice, but was also directed to influence the proceedings in Parliament, and that is a direct direction from our High Court. So, we can continue, and we will not leave these hearings as a party, but I want to place that on a record, not only for today and for this legislation, but also for future reference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Delport. I'll take Mr. Joubert, the last one, and then we'll ask the co-chair then to assist each other in responding. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I fully support Dr. Delport, but I want to raise a point on procedure, but on a slightly different matter. And that is, you know, the Glenister case will be heard by the Constitutional Court on the 20th of this month. Now, my question is, wouldn't it have been prudent if we waited until the court had made its decision on this matter, rather than have the hearings now? Thank you.
The last question, I don't think that the case of Mr. Glenister has anything to do with Parliament. We are Parliament here, we've got our program that we must run with. Those are court processes. So I don't think that it would be fair for us to wait for the court hearing on Mr. Glenister application to court. I don't think it has anything to do with Parliament processes here. Ms. Kolobane?
Yes, thank you. I wonder if you could, in light of the fact that the Democratic Alliance sent through to you 100,000 signatures on petitions, which on Wednesday you said were irrelevant, and nearly 15,000 submissions, I would like to know how it is that you managed to pull this figure down to just over 100. Do you consider that the other thousands that have come through to you are also irrelevant? I know you spoke, Mr. Karim, or Honourable Karim spoke a great deal about his constituency. Could you just fill us in, please, on whether the rest of the South Africans who are not perhaps part of your political constituency are at all relevant in these proceedings?
Thank you very much, Ms. Kolobane. Let me respond immediately to your question about the figures that you spoke about, that we gave on Wednesday. I think we put it very clear on Wednesday about the figures that because of the meeting that was already scheduled, that is the public hearings for Wednesday, we had to take the figures that we received, but the committee section was still busy compiling all the figures. And then we said, after we received all the figures, then we'll start with the public hearings, of which we do have the total number of figures now. The ones that we gave on Wednesday, we put it very clear that those were not the total figures that we received because of the time that came for the media briefing. Honourable Swart?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just we as ACDP share the sentiments previously expressed by the previous speakers, but I would like to raise a separate issue, and I don't expect a ruling immediately. It's quite a sensitive issue, and maybe you could refer to the parliamentary legal advisers. Our concern relates to those members of parliament that have been investigated by the Scorpions or are being investigated by the Scorpions. We are not sure if there are members here that are part of these two committees, but we raise our concern that we would believe it's a conflict of interest for such members to be sitting on the future of a body that is investigating them, and we'd ask you to obtain legal advice in this regard as to whether it is correct that they should be sitting in this matter. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Frost. We take note of that. Honourable Sicelo?
Thank you, Chairperson. Well, I think the first thing that we must agree upon is that we are here today to get a briefing from the department. Therefore, we must not be sidetracked from the objective of this meeting here. The other thing, Chair, is that there are people here who are quoting you who are not part of the press briefing. And in so doing, they are misquoting you. Because what you presented, we listen to yourself. You must listen to us. We listen to yourself. We never objected when you're speaking. Therefore, learn to listen to other people when they're on the floor. I will request the person to protect me. I'm on the floor.
Oh, really?
Yes. I'm saying these individuals, Chairperson, they are misquoting you. They're not part of the press briefing. Because what you expressed in the press briefing was the fact that what we have on the table are the views of the executive. The views of the executive that says that the DSO has to be relocated. That's what you expressed on the table, which then you elaborated on that. Now, which people who were in the public hearing, we said in that press briefing that the Parliament is going to listen to the views of the public. On the basis of the views expressed by the public, we'll take a decision. And we stated in that press briefing that Parliament as a body doesn't have a view on the matter. Therefore, these individuals who are speaking here, they are misquoting you, Chairperson, and I would propose that we move and get to the business of the day. And we know that these individuals disagree with us on issues. It's not going to change today and now. And we're not going to be sidetracked. We want to engage with the process, and we're calling upon the people out there to engage with the process of the bid so that we're able to come with a quality bill. In that respect, I request that we move and engage on the business of the day. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shipeza. I'll give to my co-chair here.
Just very quickly, look, at the end of the day, I think very interesting questions were raised at the press conference and here about the relationship between a decision made by 4,000 delegates at a conference, a majority party that commands 70% of the elected support, the role of Parliament, and democracy. These are very interesting questions. There are no easy answers to them. I think that last week's press conference was substantially skewed because there were misrepresentations in the press by a certain party in particular about the thousands and thousands of submissions made. Now, in reply to Ms. Kola Bana, there's a very simple solution. The figures that we were given are 116 submissions in the formal sense that you get written representations that say, we're unhappy with the bill, it's either an organization or an individual. Kola Bana, I think, has been an MP for 4 years, she knows what we mean. All of us do. Written submissions are 116. Can we ask the committee section to take Ms. Kola Bana and whoever wants to go, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and take her through all these submissions. And can they report back to this House tomorrow at 9:30 as to what the figures are? At this stage, it's 116 submissions. At 10:30 last night, a senior committee manager told me it's 116 formal submissions that say, we're opposed to the bill in general ways, and then they give you specific amendments. Some don't say anything about specific amendments, but that's fine. 116. For now, Lolly, is that correct? 116. Can you take Ms. Kola Barnard and one person from each of the opposition parties? The ANC doesn't need to go. And can you confirm that tomorrow? 116. Then can you haul out all the submissions? And if she can send a researcher, can the researcher go and count them? Yesterday, somewhere between, we get slightly conflicting figures, but I think at the maximum, it is possibly at around 100,000 names, right? In the form of three petitions. What is it, Lori?
I got 12,000 plus. Jeremy got 17,000 plus petitions, and my colleague Bonani got 15,000 plus. Those are petitions only.
Can you make a time with her and take her to the office and show her? So whatever the figure is, it's hovering somewhere between 55,000 and maybe 100,000. We have not, the co-chair did not say that we're going to ignore, they don't matter. What she said was, we will give it due weight. And I'm also quoted as saying that. However, it does not help us in the processing of the clause by clause. So we are still saying to these people, as we said at the outset, the chairperson said, co-chair said, these people that have signed petitions, it's not a numbers game. Somebody said to me, it's not a referendum. It's a processing of a bill. So we are urging these people to present to us, they have up to the 19th of August, concrete amendments on the bills. So on the issue that Kola Barnard raises, Ms. Kola Barnard, that can be resolved very quickly. On the Glenister case, we will consult with Parliament's lawyers, but to my understanding, until the court decides otherwise, Parliament proceeds. I'm not a lawyer. JJ, if you want to add anything there, and otherwise, JB, do you want to add? No, until the court decides otherwise, Parliament continues. And interestingly, it's a challenge around to what extent can a court in any democracy prevent a Parliament from passing a bill? Even though we're a constitutional court, I'll have you in a moment. I've just been, on the issue of, did we, it's outrageous to suggest that we said these submissions don't matter. The 116 submissions, quite frankly, asked out of them, only 30 to 35 have asked for presentations before our committee. In fact, the public hearings would have finished in 2 days. We reached out to people and said, quite frankly, you have written, don't you want to come and appear? So, I think it's outrageous to suggest that we said we will ignore this. Finally, yes, there was a specific context for last week. We are now, Dr. Delaporte, I addressed myself specifically to the Justice Committee members who are active, Len, Steve. We're going to do exactly on these bills what we did on the Child Justice Bill. And you know how the Justice Committee operates. So, the jury is out on us. The jury is out on us. The clipping that appears on ETV actually has me saying something very different from the SABC. I only saw that last night. It has me saying that if the overwhelming majority of South Africans, not least the voters of the majority party, clearly indicate in these public hearings that they are opposed to the dissolution of the Scorpions. Surely Parliament cannot ignore that. Surely Parliament will have to act accordingly. Surely the majority party is not so foolish and foolhardy on the eve of an election, knowing full well its own electorate, its own voters are opposed to it, decide not to consider some form or other of a review. Finally, these public hearings are not just about whether the Scorpions should exist or not. They are also about if the Scorpions are to be located, on what terms indeed they should be relocated within the SAPS. We can all contribute, even those of us opposed to the dissolution, to ensure that this new unit, what if it emerges, is far more effective in fighting organized crime and corruption, even if we're unhappy about dissolving the Scorpions. May I ask a rhetorical question? If in Britain the Labour Party decides its policy is to dissolve the House of Lords, do those who are opposed to the dissolution of the House of Lords say no? The Labour Party is in the majority in the British Parliament. They are having public hearings on the dissolution of the House of Lords. I don't agree, therefore I'm not going to participate. No. At the very least, the role of an opposition party is to recognize you're an opposition, that you can't always get your way. But what you can do, at the very least by participating in public hearings and actively in committees, is to restrain the majority party from fully having its way. It's at least within the decision, policy decision of the majority party to shape the detail. That's what democracy is about. In short, the jury is out on us, whatever we might have said last week. Let us see, 6 weeks from now, where we are. And I suspect many of you, if you want to be honest, will see that the bills will be processed, and the Justice Committee in particular, there will be no difference. Comrade Maggie and I have discussed the matter in the way we proceed with other bills. So I'm pleading with people like Bill and others are saying, we should move on now, and let's see what the next 6 weeks tell.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm not taking other hands now. We are proceeding with the hearings.
There's one question outstanding about the members that have been investigated.
I think we will respond immediately to Honourable Swartz and say that we've taken note of that and then we'll refer that to Parliament.
Chairperson, Mr. Sivanyoni's hand has been up for a long time.
Honourable Davey, I see you have a lawyer this side.
First of all, I would like to thank Coach Van der Merwe. Coach Chairperson, very briefly, the general principles of our law is ius dicere, non potere, which has to do with the separation of powers. I'm adding briefly on what the co-chairperson, Mr. Karim, said, that no court can prevent Parliament from making laws on the basis of the separation of powers. In terms of our law, it's only after we've made a law. If a person argues that our law conflicts or contradicts the Constitution, it's only at that stage that that law can be challenged. But it has never happened that the court can prevent us before we even pass that law to stop from doing it. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Makwanisha, last one.
Yes, Chairperson, I think that the debate is misplaced. The first item on the agenda is the review of the South African criminal justice system. I don't know where this debate takes us from. I think let's go to the first item on the agenda.
Thank you very much, Honourable Makwanisha. We are then going to focus on the program or the agenda. We'll start by taking the overview of the proposed new integrated criminal justice system, followed by the National Prosecution Authority Amendment Bill and the South African Police Service Amendment Bill. Thereafter, then, we'll be engaged in the discussions. Honourable, who is supposed to be that? Honourable Deputy Minister?
Yeah.
Honourable Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson. May I first apologise? I got out of sick bed and I am still struggling, spluttering and blowing nose and so on. So I apologise. Secondly, it's good to see that nothing in Parliament has changed. 15 years later, it's like these soapies. You watch the soapie well, this year and the next year you come back, you just start off exactly at the same spot. You haven't missed anything. So it's quite nice. I could have predicted this morning. I just wouldn't have predicted that Mr. Groenewald and all those people that are never here have come today. But other than that, I would have predicted exactly what happened.
The indication I got was for 10 o'clock, not 9:30.
Can I start off by thanking the committees for requesting us to come and present this, what I regard as a major initiative, to try and see how we strengthen our criminal justice system in a way that we combat crime and in a way that we change the unacceptable crime trends that exist today. I think no one will suggest that we don't have a problem with crime. I think what happens sometimes is that sometimes it's so overwhelming that we don't know what to do about it, and that's more the problem of it. I hope that by presenting this review you would see that government, at least now for a year and more, have been looking very carefully at this matter to see how we can make fundamental changes that will make the criminal justice system look in. You must leave my gravelly voice. All the great singers have gravelly voices. So I hope that this review will show you where we've identified where major changes have to take place, and that we as a nation tackle this in a responsible way, so that in a few years from now, the criminal justice system we have now, we will not recognize anymore. So I would like to say that that is a background. Obviously, when this review starts working, Parliament's going to have a very vital role to keep monitoring and doing oversight on whether we're actually really tackling the real issues. I think for too long, the debate on crime and the way to resolve it has been a very narrow and a very partisan and political response to it. I trust that we will be able to get a bipartisan approach to try dealing with these issues. I start with the introduction. You will remember that in February this year, in the State of the Nation Address, President Thabo Mbeki said, Cabinet has agreed on a set of changes that are required to establish a new, modernized, efficient, and transformed criminal justice system. Among other things, this will entail setting up a new coordinating and management structure for the criminal justice system at every level, from national to local, bringing together the judiciary and magistracy, the police, prosecutors, correctional services, and the legal aid board, as well as other interventions, including the empowerment of community forums, end of quote. This statement by the President followed the approval by Cabinet on 7 November 2007 of a package of 7 fundamental and far-reaching transformative changes that must all be adopted and implemented in an integrated and holistic manner to achieve a new dynamic and coordinated criminal justice system. In giving the recommendations its stamp of approval, the Cabinet has embarked upon a fundamental and radical journey from what is best described as a fragmented, unfocused, and dysfunctional criminal justice system that is mainly driven or not by the strength of personalities and leadership positions to a criminal justice system that is focused, coordinated, and well-managed at every level. The 7-point plan, which follows an in-depth investigation by the 4 core departments and other stakeholders into the present criminal justice system that is plagued with blockages and weaknesses, rendering it inefficient and ineffective in many ways, could represent a major sustainable step towards combating crime and reversing the unacceptable levels of crime. This review emanated, as has already been pointed out, very much from a joint venture with business that started in August of 2006 and which culminated in the adoption of these 7 points by a Cabinet. And since then, in May this year, I was appointed to coordinate this initiative to bring it to fruition. And that structure of ours has started operating in June. And therefore, the input I'm giving is partly a mixture of the original review and its proposals, and already some of the things that we've decided to do is part of the whole input that we're giving. Now, in the perfect world, if you look at that nice little sketch there, that is how the criminal justice system should work in an integrated manner. You commit a crime, it's reported, it's investigated, then you arrest, then the prosecutors deal with it, goes to the courts, you get some rehabilitation, you get integrated back into society. That is the perfect world. I don't know of any system in the world where that works exactly like that, but of course different systems have levels of functionality to varying degrees. What our review has shown that whole pretty little picture there is more dealt with in the default than in the reality. And I have no hesitation and the Cabinet has had no hesitation to saying that various parts of our criminal justice system shows high levels of dysfunctionality. The overall objectives, I'll just quickly list for you, because they are important, and not just paper. That is really setting the framework of where we want to go. Firstly, we need to improve the legitimacy and the public confidence in the criminal justice system. There's no doubt that from apartheid days that our justice system has very low levels of legitimacy. And although it has increased somewhat during the democratic phase that we're in, it is clear that we do not yet have legitimacy and the full public confidence. Secondly, that there are various weaknesses and blockages in the criminal justice system which have to be removed through short, medium, and long-term interventions. In other words, there's no big bang solution. Some issues we can deal with quickly, some will have to take a bit longer, and some will even take longer than that. Then we also have the objective of a sustained efficiency and effectiveness through improved coordination and management. And I'll get back to this. This is one of the real big problems that we have in the system. Fourthly, we would want appropriate, effective, and integrated information technology and communication systems and a national reliable criminal justice database that serves the criminal justice system as a whole and provides relevant and timely information to all the shareholders. In the rest of the input that you see, that is a big wish we have. It definitely does not exist at all in the criminal justice system at the moment. And lastly, we need optimal community involvement through CPFs, etc. Then we turn to the outcomes of the... This thing is just doesn't want to... Okay. The desired outcomes is firstly the identification of key weaknesses and blockages. Secondly, the acceptance of all stakeholders into a multifaceted plan of action. This is a great weakness we have. We operate in silos, and we do not have necessarily multifaceted plans of action. Thirdly, the endorsement and buying of all participating entities, and I hope that we can place Parliament and even the opposition parties in that category. Fourthly, sustained efficiency and effectiveness of the criminal justice system by improved coordination and management of the system as a whole. Quality and professional services in an integrated, coordinated, effective criminal justice. That, of course, hardly exists. Swift, equitable, and fair justice, and an effective deterrent. The greatest deterrent, if you go and read the Constitutional Court judgments, particularly the one dealing with the death penalty, is that if you study anywhere in the world, that there is a great consensus that your most effective deterrent is whether you catch criminals and whether you punish them accordingly. And this is a very important point. If we get the system to work more effectively, and that people will know that if they get caught, they're going to be dealt with severely, that would be the greatest deterrent against crime. And I think this is borne out by international best practice. And then ultimately resulting in a modernized criminal justice system with a single vision and mission, leading to joint objectives, joint priorities, and joint performance measurements. Big weakness in the present system. Across the cluster, and the elimination of present misaligned priorities and targets. I think we have to admit to ourselves that a lot of our problems do emanate from the previous dispensation. But in the last 15 years, we have not necessarily always taken the right decisions, the right resource allocations in the right places to give us the right results and outcomes almost 15 years down the line in democracy. And we have to bite that bullet. This is just the headline targets. You don't have to go into much detail, but what we're looking for is effective justice, swift justice, efficient justice, accessible justice. Those are the targets that we're aiming for, and those are the indicators by which we will measure from now on once we've got the system running. Now, the approach we follow to this review has been different of previous approaches. You will know that previous approaches, those of you in the Justice Committee, and I imagine in safety and security, over the years is that we have employed many, many consultants. In fact, I have got reports of consultants that can fit into one half of my room at the moment. Because we keep getting people from outside analyzing what the problem is, which we tell them, by the way, what the problem is, government. They then write it up for us, they send it back to us and tell us, this is your problem, and we go back to the next consultancy and we get the report. That's the problem with consultancy. Consultancies come and their ability is to write up things. Their ability is not necessarily to find solutions and actually to implement solutions. Only government can do that, and that is a lot of times where we've failed in this regard. The one thing that this analysis will show you, or this approach that we've adopted, this review, is that our problems are not unique. These problems are universal and very similar in other democracies. Obviously, the degree would vary depending on your level of development of the country and the age of your democracy. Clearly, you cannot measure a country like ours, who's less than 14 years old, measure it with a democracy like the United States. I mean, you've had 300, 400 years to fine-tune, to change, and so on. And the quote I have there is a very interesting quote, and I wish that in Parliament we keep remembering this. A judge in the United States many, many years, I think it was more than 100 years ago, said about the criminal justice system in the United States, "The criminal justice system is a system of 200 years of tradition, unimpeded by progress." Unimpeded by progress. And if you actually study the systems, it's true, because a criminal justice system is really the practices and the norms and the procedures that becomes the reality of how you deal with crime over time. If you go and ask many people that are practicing in the criminal justice system, very few of them would show you the source of what they do every day and how and for what reason. They wouldn't even know the legislation. You come into the job, you get socialized as a youngster into the job, and then you start doing the job by rote as you go on. That's why the system doesn't really change, because we all come into the system, we play our roles and so on. And hopefully this project, this review we are dealing with, will break that cycle. And that in future, one of your kids who's going to be a very bright kid on the high courts will actually be able to say, our criminal justice system is a system of 350 years of tradition, which 300 and more of it is a colonialist tradition, and the other one is an apartheid tradition. But now say it is impeded by progress. That will be very useful if we can say that in our system. As I said, our approach has been different. We actually went to the grassroots. We went to all parts of the country. We met at the coalface with leaders in the criminal justice system, and we discussed not problems with them, we discussed solutions with them. Those of you in the Justice Committee will know that we did a similar task many years ago when we visited PE for 2 weeks, and we did exactly the same thing. It's going down and letting people tell us what the solution should be. The other thing we've done very differently is that we've taken all the statistics we can find in the system, and we try to analyze the performance in the system by very much weighing it up against the capacity we have in the system to produce those results. And one of the issues we have found is that the capacity in the system is highly dysfunctional and probably is one of the major causes for the dysfunctionalities that we find in the system. I will just now elaborate on that whole analysis we did, because there are difficulties that we had with it. But through this grassroots engagement and through this analysis that was done for the first time ever, as I'm aware of in the country, we were able to identify the obstacles and the problems and come up with these 7 solutions. Now let me deal in the next 3 slides with the actual, giving you a narrative of the facts that we found. The measurement of performance in the system was done through looking at actual performance in the criminal justice system. In other words, taking the numbers through the system, how many crimes are detected, how many actually go to court, how many that are in court actually land between front of a magistrate or a judge, and then what the results of it, to try and give that analysis, and then matching it up with capacity. The problem is, though, and this is one of the big problems, one of the 7 problems we have to deal with, we do not have a national criminal justice database. So all the decisions we take in the criminal justice system are unscientific, if there is such a word. They're just a thumbsuck of what we think is in the system and not necessarily what is. Because the problem that you have is, if Kwesi Namara, the Honourable, were to murder Len Yubel, the Honourable, not a bad, for crossing the floor, it's not a bad idea. Parliament wouldn't be so much fun without Kwesi. Then we do not give Kwesi's murder M6 of 08. And we don't keep that number throughout the system so that we can actually trace. We found a body. Someone said murder next to it, which is usually a very junior policeman, because there's a body. So you put murder. That goes as the statistic murder. Later on, we found out that Quiz died from an overdose of Viagra. The moment was too big. Which has got nothing to do with murder, it's got everything to do with the wrong lifestyle practices you have. But the point I'm trying to make is, you cannot trace through the system now. You have to go, if the person that found the body in the mortuary gives it a number, then the forensic people will give it a number, then the detectives will give it a number, then the prosecuting authority, then the courts and the prison. So if you want to find out what happened in a particular case, you actually have to go manually and look at each of those systems to try and see. And of course, they even spell the names wrong, so you probably won't even find the person in the system. So that is the first problem. And so when you look at statistics, the different departments keep snapshots of that year. So that year, like this year, we had 2-point-something million new cases coming into the reported in the system. We haven't got a clue how many cases are left over from previous years. And then they deal with the results in that year, but you cannot analyze it other than a whole next year. You cannot analyze it as per crime, how it's gone through the system and whether where we're failing or where it stops and doesn't stop. So the statistics doesn't really help us, particularly to try and make comparisons. But what it does show us is trends, which are very clearly discernible. And those trends are mostly negative and show cases of dysfunctionality. So although we did this analysis does have weaknesses. Because until we have a holistic criminal justice system that speaks from the beginning to the end, we do not really know what happens. No one can tell you in this country what happened with a particular case, unless they go and sit for hours and days taking one case and tracing it manually through the system. And therefore, it's difficult to make comparisons to know what cycle times are, how long we take with these things, cases that aren't detected and so on. But despite these shortcomings we have in the system, the following trends can probably be noted under performance. Firstly, that the statistics indicate a large proportion of all reported crime as being undetected. Not being having a perpetrator and there, but being undetected completely. We don't know and haven't got a clue, not even a rumor of a name of a person that may have committed that crime. There are large numbers of those cases in the system. Furthermore, once we have found the possible perpetrators, and we've detected them, a substantial number of cases are closed as unfounded or not establishing prima facie cases or complainants withdrawing charges. So first you have a lot of cases undetected, and then you have a large portion of those cases where they may have a perpetrator which actually never reach court because not enough evidence is found or the complainant withdraws the case. Following this, the number of charges then referred to court and being finalized relative to the crimes reported are consequently low. Now, I am going to deal with capacity much more in detail later on, but just to give you a glimpse of capacity during the investigation aid stage, the performance we would suggest through the review of this large measure of dysfunctionality prior to court is in a big measure, not the only factor, but in a big measure the reason of capacity shortcomings. And these capacity shortcomings are reflected in various ways, but just look at this. We have insufficient number of crime scene experts. In this country last year, we had 1,691 crime scene experts. This year it's gone up to 2,082. Now, imagine in this country we have 2 million reported cases. Our figure has come down from about 2.8 a few years ago to 2,000 now. But all those crime scenes, of which at least 650,000 of them are contact crime, serious crime, and 500,000 of it property crimes, of those, we only have 1,691 people to go to the crime scene and actually find evidence on the crime scene. Obviously, the evidence you find on the crime scene is the most devastating objective evidence you can find. And it's the kind of evidence that back up your eyewitnesses. So, the biggest secret kept in this country at the moment is that probably more than 50% of crime scenes are never visited by a crime scene expert. I think the figure is bigger, because you don't have to be a genius. If you divide 1,691 into the number of reported crime, plus all the crime that's still left over from previous years, you do not have to be a genius to work out that we will not have people to be able to go and visit those crime scenes. And last year we had 923 experts. Those are the people in the labs that are doing the tests. This year the figure has gone up to about 1,000 or so. So you can see immediately there is a huge constraint on our forensic capacity. Those of you that watch CSI, Miami, I know most of you don't watch it just for the pretty people in the things. You watch it because of the content and so on. But that is the type of thing we're talking about. Our forensic capacity here is what is called CSI in America. So you can imagine what capacity we have if we only have 1,691 people scattered in 91 offices around the country having to collect forensic evidence at the crime scene. Huge, huge capacity problems. The second one is that the relative small capacity of people that investigate crime, in other words, detectives. When we looked at this issue originally, there were only 13.6% of detectives were part of the police force. So 87% of your police force did other things. Only about, let's make it a round figure, 15% in this police force we have now, 15% are forensic experts and detectives that actually have the job to go and identify criminals, collect evidence to prove the commission of whatever crime they've committed, and then to make sure that evidence is laid in court and a conviction is given. So our whole system, I would suggest, lacks and has been starved of oxygen in terms of capacity at the main place, and that is the coal face where you investigate crime, where you collect evidence, and you then get that evidence in court to prove. So all these lot of theories, particularly by some people on the other side in the media about visible policing and all those things, I mean, that cannot be our priority, in my view. It can definitely not be our priority. The real problem that we have, and when you look at these figures and these statistics and you look how dysfunctional our system is, the real problem we have is that we have to strengthen in a big way and with bigger numbers and better quality work at the coal face of investigation. That is the way you turn around crime, not through other means and so on. So we need to look at certain issues. And that brings me to the last point, is that over even the last 13 years, we've had inadequate or incorrect policy choices or resource allocations. In some instances, I want to... Therefore, the conclusion on the investigation stage, because I'm dealing with the investigation stage, is that cases will continue to not be detected or to be withdrawn in large numbers before and even after reaching the courts. Inter alia, if policies and resource allocation are not radically changed to single-mindedly focus on creating the necessary capacity to detect criminals and to gather credible evidence to ensure convictions in court. In other words, if adequate capacity to gather evidence at the crime scene and to investigate crimes, especially serious crimes, is not created, the outcomes performance of our criminal justice system will largely remain dysfunctional. The second stage, are you there? Which is the adjudicating stage, suffers of the same weaknesses as the other one. We get a snapshot for that year, but we don't know what comes over from the previous year, and there's no indication of what goes over to the next year. All that our departments do, they do a snapshot of that year. And the same weaknesses we have here. Firstly, the low number of charges being referred to court relative to the number of crimes reported is compounded by the many charges withdrawn or struck off the roll after being introduced in court. And just to give you a figure here, we have at least of the amount of cases that go to court every year. Last year, 720,000 of those cases were either withdrawn or struck off the roll. This year, the figure has gone lower at 655,000, but you can see that there are at more between 500,000 and 750,000 dockets that go into the system every year, is administered by detectives, by prosecutors, by courts, spending all that time on administering it just to be removed from the system again. So that is one of the major areas we want to deal with, is to stop this huge administrative burden of having to handle this 650,000 cases. Secondly, the number of finalized cases, those are guilty, not guilty, all those that you see there, is low measured against the number of cases enrolled. And I show you there how we calculate that. The number of property crime finalized by the courts is very low. In fact, if you want to be a criminal, go and become a property crime criminal, your chances are much better than any casino of you getting away with it. Whilst contact crime is higher, but not much so. A further consequence is that we have a 35% backlog of cases in the regional court. If you know that the regional court deals with most of our cases and about 80,000 cases a year, new ones going to the court, we have it running a backlog of 35%. Those are cases that are on the roll for longer than 9 months. The other consequence is that we have 48,000 awaiting trial detainees in our facilities. People who have not gone through the system, but they've been kept in prison, some of them for years. And that number fluctuates between 52,000 and 48,000 at the moment. Of course, of that 48,000, more than 11,000 of them were actually given bail, but cannot afford it. So 11,000 people can be removed immediately from the 48,000 if the bail conditions were to change and those people were left out because they can't pay to leave. That's the kind of dysfunctionality we're talking about. In fact, it would be better for government to pass a law that they should pay the bail of people in lesser crimes than it would cost us to keep those people in prison. If we went to pay the bail as government, it would cost us 20, 30 times less than to keep those people in a waiting trial. Where the courts have already decided that person is not a threat and to be given bail, we still keep 11,000 in prison because they can't pay the bail. And then, of course, all of us know this one, the low court hours. On average, the regional courts, if you take all their cases every day and you divide them up, they work about 3.5 hours a day. The low number of finalized cases, and this is a worrying figure, if you take all the regional courts in this country, on average, they finish only 7 cases a month last year. This year, it's gone backwards. It's 6 cases on average a month. So all the regional courts, you take all of them, all the work they do every single day, all 300 and whatever of them, and you divide it all up, then they only finish, at this year, only finish on average 6 cases per court. And that is why you can imagine why you've got backlogs of 30,000-40,000. Yes, yes, 6 per month. Capacity. I'll show you figures just now of the capacity of our courts and our prosecutors. My own view is at this stage we don't have capacity problems in those courts because if they're only working 3.5 hours, they can't have a capacity problem. What they have is they've got a work problem, not a capacity problem. And then we'll look at those statistics. The conclusion here is that the bottom line is that if that an unacceptably low number of reported cases translates into cases actually reaching our courts, and of those cases that are referred to court, a large number are removed from the court roll, and only a small number of cases are placed before a judicial officer and finalized through the courts in any given year. So if efficiency and capacity do not improve, the number of cases appearing before a judicial officer will continue decreasing. The number of cases finalized will decrease even further, as is happening at the moment. Court hours will further shrink. Cycle times will become even longer. And ultimately the backlogs will increase. In the incarceration stage, I don't have to say much there except that clearly the amount of people we incarcerate are not sustainable in our prisons. One of the other problems we have with capacity is not only prisons, but the options outside of prison, so parole, probation, correctional supervision. To make those function in any system, you need to have people that work outside of prisons to make sure they monitor and control those people. Now, I don't know if you know, a year or two ago, there was a newspaper article here that the young lady here in Cape Town, she handles 800 such people. That is how low the capacity is. She must monitor 800 people that are out on parole and so on to see if they're sticking to their conditions. So there's a capacity problem in our alternative options outside of prison. Now, just to summarize the weaknesses that we have found, the review, especially the perform stroke capacity analysis, provides overwhelming evidence of a dysfunctional criminal justice system that spans across multiple departments and agencies involving vast numbers of personnel, process, and information that has to function harmoniously, resulting in high levels of fragmentation, dysfunctionality, many blockages and obstacles, high levels of accountability, unaccountability, and overall system weaknesses. This dysfunctional criminal justice system is reflected in complex and multifaceted weaknesses, including different and disparate legislative and policy frameworks and mandates, crucial gaps in overarching policies and legislation, are often unattended due to absence of clearly defined accountability, the absence of an integrated national criminal justice system as opposed to separately managed departments and agencies, a system not geared to focus on problem resolution and referral of cases upwards for political solving, and no home for criminal justice problems. There's problems, justice problems, there's police problems, but we don't deal as in the system with criminal justice system problems, which are cross-cutting. And in some instances of inadequate and incorrect prioritization and resource allocation. The system as a whole is fully dependent on each of its component parts and their correct functioning. But dysfunctional behavior is often accommodated and accepted as the norm and not corrected. There are no mechanisms in the systems to encourage continuous improvement. Cross-cutting management information systems and timeless provision of relevant information and system infrastructure at all points is lagging behind international standards. Absence of formal coordination structures throughout the system, lacking hands-on involvement and collective management. For example, departments are individually coordinated and managed with differing degrees of success, efficiency, and competency. And the criminal justice system as a single entity system is not appropriately managed or coordinated. I would say it's not managed or coordinated at all. The conclusion then of the review team was that a fundamental and radical departure from what presently exists is required to transform the present criminal justice system, which is fragmented, unfocused, mainly driven by the strength of the personalities, or should I say egos, of individuals in leadership positions into a criminal justice system which is focused, coordinated, and well-managed at every level. Skip that next slide. After do those... No, it's not embarrassing at all, it's just time constraints. Have a look at it later. After our analysis of these matters and our consultations, we placed those seven recommendations before Cabinet. And I am going to deal with each one individually now to show you what we're doing about them. But just quickly to run through them. And it's important to note that you can't fix up one of these things. You have to fix up all of them. You won't be able to do it at the same time. But as long as there are plans in place that all seven of the changes are taking place. If the one doesn't take place and the others do, you will retain large parts of your dysfunctionality. So all seven of these have to kick in and be successful to varying degrees. The first one is such an obvious one, but if you go and look at the system at grassroots level, you cannot believe how the departments work against each other. And we need a single vision and mission for the criminal justice. Each department has a vision and mission, but they do not have a single one, and they do not target and focus their activities as to measurements that are agreed to across the board. So each department has its own vision, mission, its own targets, its own performance agreement. And these work against each other. For example, detectives get into big trouble if they don't dump X amount of files in court every month. They've got targets. They have to put certain... doesn't matter if it's finished. It doesn't matter the quality. They might just reach court, and then they fulfill their task. The prosecutors, in turn, they have got performance agreements in terms of the time they spend in courts and the time of cases they finalize. So they would definitely not look at cases that are marginal or that they'll just go for the ones that are going to boost their performance. So the system works against each other because we do not have a single vision and mission, and we do not have targets and priorities and measurements attached to that vision and mission that all of us complain to take away the conflicting things that are happening. Secondly, there is no criminal justice structure. It doesn't exist. Each department has a structure, and at national level we are clustered as a cluster. But nowhere has the system got at every level, at provincial level, at local level, got people sitting down and talking about the problems of the criminal justice system. And I'll tell you just now what we're doing about that. Thirdly, the court processes. I've just told you 700,000 odd cases go into the system every year, come out. Those processes have to change so that all that admin things are taken out and we concentrate on court cases. Fourthly, we have key priority areas, particularly around capacity, that we have to change. And I've mentioned two of them already in the police force that has to change. Fifthly, I've already alluded to the whole issue of having a seamless national database. Sixthly, there are a lot of programs in government where we're trying to modernize the system from manual. The system mainly is manual. You write on cards. Everything. Maintenance, you write on cards. Bail, you write on cards. It's easy to throw a card away. But the creating of systems where you can keep all this on IT, that is one. And then seventhly, the involvement of our people. That's a nice little diagram. You see that diagram? No, the next one. This little diagram shows what the problem is. The criminal justice system is a pipe running horizontally. And at different stages, you have different inputs. Firstly, you have the reporting of a crime. Then you have crime scene investigation and investigation. Then you have arrest, then prosecution, then adjudication, then incarceration, and then integration to society. The problem is the system runs like that, and it's a system, it's a pipe, it's one thing. Whereas we and other countries structure our departments vertically across this. So immediately, you can see a systemic problem. Because it's fine where police, NPA and there are, you can have legislation that sets out their line of control. But what you're not dealing with is what happens in between. Where police have to relate to prosecutors, prosecutors have to relate to courts. Those are not regulated and are completely unaccountable in our system. And it's exacerbated by our more silo approach. So instead of just having departments running across, that second bullet told you, the second change, is to find a system that spans the whole thing and tries to fix it up so that the system does work as a pipe and is not broken all the way along the way. You can imagine if water runs through the pipe and you've got breakages all along, the amount of water that comes out at the end is going to be minuscule. Whereas if the pipe is fixed, a strong stream will come out at the end in terms of results. And that is where you find your dysfunctionality. Now, the first recommendation I've spoken to somewhat, that is but this is probably one of the most difficult things. To get departments to agree to target measurements and realistic ones, what they do, they go to the system as it works now. Then they say, we only finalize 6 regional court cases per month per regional court. Therefore, our target should be 6. So they go to the lowest common denominator everywhere in the criminal justice system. We go to the lowest common denominator, put that as a target, and we pay people performance bonuses when they go over the lowest common denominator. Because a lot of our performance agreements, I'm afraid, has got to do with the work you should be doing in any case. Your performance agreement is you must do the following, which if you didn't have a performance agreement would have been exactly the same. So if you do all these things, we'll pay you a bonus. So that's why everyone gets bonus on a 12th, 13th check. There's no system of assessment of performance in the system. It doesn't work like that. And in the criminal justice system, even worse, because each one does it on its own without thinking of the other departments. And therefore, you get the lowest common denominator as being the guiding force. So as far as I'm concerned, when we set these targets, it will be about 15 per court. Because the point is, we've got backlog courts, and maybe we'll come and report to you at some stage on the backlog courts. There we have found that those are people we brought from outside. It's dependent on whether they hold their job and how many cases they finalize. There you get guys finishing 20, 30 cases a month, on average. So you can see if the system works, it actually can produce that kind of result. In fact, the guy who finishes 20, 30 a month actually sits for shorter than the other courts. So what you've got is efficiency, cases going through it, you've got a court working efficiently with the same timeline, but the results are triple what you get normally. So the backlog project has shown us a lot of things where people that are there on a contract We don't backlog courts. We will not continue with them if they're underperforming. If they become like other courts, we close them down. So, of course, there you'll find certain efficiencies have developed. And then the biggest problem for us, even if we agree to the vision and mission and all the targets and the priorities, we're going to have to get each department to realign their departments to that. And this is where Parliament's going to have to play a big role, particularly justice and safety and security, to make sure that departments do a realign so that we're all pushing in the same direction. The second recommendation that I have stated is to create a criminal justice coordinating and management system. Let me actually skip a few. Let's not look at the words. Let's go to the map quickly. What we're looking at is to create that structure at a national level. You'll see that the usual cabinet, JCPS cluster, IMS, and the departments, they're intact. Remember, this is a coordinating and management structure we're creating, so it's got no executive functions. Whatever we get agreed to, that still has to go through the cabinet process, and the departments must implement it. Of course, we will be able to monitor now to what extent they do it, but the government structure remains intact and is still the main driving force. But what you will have is you'll have an Office of the Criminal Justice System Reform. It'll have a secretariat. It'll have a war room. Now, this war room is very important. You see, one thing we don't have in our system, we don't have a quick response cross-cutting on operational issues. You look at the xenophobia matters. If we had a system that operated properly, in my view, and one of our main leaders I spoke to the other day has a similar view, so I can use it because it's got some balance then. But what we should do in those cases, if it happens, the xenophobia things, you should really throw, the first place it happens, you throw a ring of steel around it. You get the perpetrators, you have them in court the next week. These people that burned down the building, we should have a response that we immediately send task teams in, grab the culprits, and make sure that within a week or two, we have them in court. These things that can spark bigger things. The problem is the system doesn't cater for them at all. In fact, when cabinet and government decided we're going to treat the xenophobia cases with urgency and give them priority and move them through the system to show the world that we're dealing with these culprits, once you get the report, which I've received, most of the report says further investigation. So we're back. So we somehow catch culprits. On what basis, I'm not sure. And then somehow we have to go further investigate. Now that is an on-the-scene issue. It's not as if someone came in and reported a crime. It's on the scene. And we should have responded by this time, although in the Cape here we've got about 14 cases that are going to run in the coming week from the 6th of August. But as a whole, it's just not. So the first thing we're looking at is having a war room where we can, in certain instances, as the police and prosecutors and crime intelligence intervene in major issues which could have a kickback into society. As I say, xenophobia cases, there's people burning down buildings when they get evicted, etc. Those things we have to butt in the nip. We're not doing it. We don't have any capacity to do that. And the police and prosecutors are now creating the capacity. We have a war room. We're starting to look at how best to deal with those issues. And that will go over to the next structure. And then, as I said, we need a national database, but I'll get to that later. Just go to the next one. And then attached to that, because we want a system that spans the whole criminal justice system, you will want to create a level of committees at provincial level to deal with provincial problems of the criminal justice system. And then, although we haven't yet divided our courts into municipalities, I think the general trend is to, when we do re-demarcate, is to do it at a municipal basis. You would want at least in each municipality to have a criminal justice system structure of all the role players to deal with problems in that area. I mean, the truck comes late every day with the prisoners. You know, how can they deal with that? Lawyers, private lawyers, double booking, not coming to court, courts have been postponed, etc. A whole lot of issues will be dealt with at a local level, at a provincial level, and a national level. And this system will, of course, be monitored and supervised, and issues will be able to go up, and issues will be able to come down, which are of a criminal justice system nature, not of a just and justice nature, and just a safety and security nature, of the cross-cutting effect of it. And then hopefully we will be able to, you'll see there, all the major role players. So we draw them in as well into the policy formulation, into solving problems in the system. There's a whole lot of other things there. I don't want to give it. Gives you a snapshot at least of what we want to move towards. Once that system is all over the country, now we will start generating reports and so on and so forth. Just go back. There. Those are the structures I discussed. Just go back another one. These are the functions we have to fulfill. Firstly, we will not, in the foreseeable future, if we do all these things and all these mechanisms, the best would have been to put it in a piece of legislation. Because then it's got binding legal effect, and people can be held accountable. But clearly, in the short term, we can't do that. So what we're going for is what we call a criminal justice system protocol. So all these things we would write into the protocol, these structures, these single vision and so on. Cabinet will approve that protocol, and all the departments will sign off on it. And that will give it also legal binding effect. If we want to then translate it later as we see how the system works into legislation, we can do so. But also what we will be doing now, which we don't do at all in the criminal justice system, we'll be creating a 3-year action plan so all of us, the parliament, all of us can follow. Are we fulfilling the 3-year action plan with business plans and with annual reports around the criminal justice system as a whole? And then lastly, as I've said, is something that I've already discussed, is to get congruent measurement systems across the criminal justice system, which are not based on the lowest common denominator. I hope that gives you some picture. That's not all the issues, but it gives you some picture. And as I said, at the national level, we will also create that national database, but I'll speak about that a bit later. Then the third recommendation is a very, very important recommendation. It is the whole restructuring of court processes in criminal matters. The present court process in criminal matters is totally antiquated, a legacy of our apartheid past, and not appropriate for a modern society. It requires a huge transformation. Our courts are not focused on trials, they're focused on admin. As I already tell you, they process at least 700,000 to 600,000 admin cases docketed through the system. So one of the big areas we're going to try and change is, if you saw the cycle of a criminal justice system just now, you usually gather information and evidence before you arrest someone. In our system, it doesn't work like that. We arrest, and then we gather information, evidence, in most instances. So your whole American probable cause issue, we don't really deal with that in South Africa. So one of the things we want to try and sort out is, if policemen are better organized, better on control of their work, then clearly we can demand different patterns of behavior when it comes to arrest. And not arresting people so they have to keep them on the system, keep them in prison, before we have even finalized our investigation. So to do that, just go to the chart. Our major changes we want to make is to create a screening mechanism. Today in our courts, only the prosecutor decides whether the case in the court will actually go ahead or not go ahead. Well, just tell me when to stop. I'll just stop when you tell me. The first thing is, if you don't know it, we have 9 to 10 regional court districts, and we concentrate on regional courts. So what we want to do is we want to create a screening mechanism in each province of the most senior prosecutor and a senior policeman who together must sign off on each docket. At the moment, only the prosecutors decide, and then they send the docket back, and the police couldn't care less sometimes. Sometimes they could care less. The docket is somewhere, you can't find it, it doesn't come back, or it comes back, it's not been dealt with. Now, by creating a senior detective who is responsible for police work at court and the quality of that work, that detective has to be higher than all the other detectives that they're going to work under, and then can tell them, which the prosecutor cannot do now, to comply with whatever is needed in the docket. Because that docket will not go on the court roll unless it's been signed off on as court ready. Of course, there are cases where you will still have investigations, where you have a person who, a youngster, 80's grandmother.
Now, that kind of person, would not want to release them, even if the investigation is not done. So, of course, those cases will be kept on the court roll. But the other big change is that all those cases will be kept on the regional court roll and not the district court roll. Because the problem with the district court roll is they have no interest in the case. They know that that case is going to the regional court. It's been said so all along. So when it comes to them for the 20th postponement, they do not ask, why are you postponing this matter? I shouldn't be postponing it. That's a regional court matter, so they just postpone it. We have cases, a lot of cases, that have up to 50 postponements. Now we have some of them, a lot of them. So what we want to try and do is to now let the regional court, from the beginning, there's a decision, these are regional court and high court cases, the regional court will be in charge because they must now see in their case that that case is dealt with properly by the detectives, and then this screening mechanism will help. And there will be a very close relationship between your regional court president, your chief detective, and your chief prosecutor. So now we're really managing the system. And then, of course, there are 10 of those. We're going to create 10 new posts. The police are busy doing it, just so we can create the, and the prosecutors as well, so we can start doing that. And then, of course, as the system starts working, we'll do it at a district level as well, particularly at the bigger towns and cities. Also create screening mechanisms. Sorry, my mouth is very dry. The other big change is an abomination. You know, we are so lazy in the criminal justice system that every time we are so lazy in the criminal justice system, all 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 of us, that we have followed practices from the old apartheid system that are still not working very well at the moment. One of them is, and of those of you that go to court will know this, you go to court, and because you're too lazy as prosecutors, as magistrates, as detectives, to want to try and subpoena witnesses when the court is ready to hear the case, every time you have a postponement, you bring the poor witnesses, they must ask leave from their bosses, they come to court, they sit there forever, and the case is postponed 50 times. A huge problem. And all of us know that when we call them to come to court and sit there, we know the case is not going to go ahead. The only reason we call them is that at the end of the day, they all get up and the magistrate, I'm warning all of you, you must be there on this and this date. That's why we call them to court. That we're going to change completely. Witnesses are only going to be called to court on the basis of the subpoena. When the case is trial ready, when the case is to run, we'll then call the witnesses to court and bring them there. Because we then know the trial will run. And I think it already creates huge legitimacy in our system if we take out this problem. It's particularly the poor that suffer, of course. Because the poor go and sit in the passages and they don't know who to talk to. And they sit there the whole day. They go back, they miss a day at work and so on. So that is the second big fundamental change. The third change that we want to make is that 85% of all cases in the regional court are defended by legal aid lawyers, and mainly from the clinics. So if most of your cases are dealt with in that way, why don't we create courts that just deal with legal aid cases? And you have one prosecutor and one public defender who's permanently in that court, and they just can run with their cases. Now we give the public defenders cases all over the place. In court 5, in court 6, in court 7, in court 8. So they must run around all the time to try and get to these cases. If we say that we're going to have one prosecutor and one public defender per court, just running legal aid matters, that court can run a continuous role. It can just keep on going because all three parties involved are there all the time. The magistrate, the prosecutor, and the public defender. Of course, there will be other courts with private lawyers and that will go on with their cases, but that's only 15% of the cases in our system. So that's the third issue. The fourth issue is that we think that the prosecutors and the legal aid board must get involved in cases much earlier. At the moment, prosecutors and legal aid is one day when you get to court, they only deal with it. We're thinking of creating extra posts in the prosecuting authority, which will not necessarily sit in courts and so on, but will, particularly with big in cities and so on, be able to work with the police in terms of collecting evidence, gathering evidence and so on. But the most important is we're busy devising an early warning system that, particularly in serious regional court cases, that every time the person wants a legal aid lawyer, they will be advised right up front with the arrest. The police will then have the duty to advise the law. So we will immediately have the legal aid board on board then, starting with the more serious cases in the regional court. So that is a change. And there are a few others which I'm not going to mention. You can look at your chart and see what it is there. But again, we've already drafted a court process protocol, which we would want all role players to sign into. We're discussing and consulting with them, the magistrates, the prosecutors, the detectives, on a court protocol, and we should have that ready quite soon. And then we will fundamentally change the way courts work. If you take this with the other things that you can start seeing why they're all linked and why all of them have to happen. And then also there's a bill in front of Parliament now. We're also trying to look at which cases should be in the system. You know, there's the funny thing that we prepared when someone drunk and driving 200 kilometers, 250 kilometers an hour, we prepare them to pay a fine of 1,000, 2,000, 10,000. But if someone slaps someone or kicks someone, which is common assault, we say, no, this person must go to court, they must face the music. Why don't we have admission of guilt for that? Slap 200 rand. Kick 300 rand. I'll pay double to kick you, Chris. So the bill that's going through Parliament now is to try and create a uniform admission of guilt, and then we'll try and get the police and the prosecutors to take, for example, all common assault cases, not get them in the courts anymore. Let them pay admission of guilt. If someone has it with any other admission of guilt that they don't want to, they go back to court. But hopefully a huge number of these cases. In fact, there's something like 210,000 common assault cases a year reported. More than 200,000. You'll be able to remove them. Criminanuria. In the Cape, yeah, it's our practice to say your ma, your pa, whatever, whatever, whatever. And that's usually criminanuria. Why not let the guy or the woman pay 100 rand or 200 rand or so on and get going again? Now we insist that this person must come to court and repeat what he said and then in any case, get 200 rand fine. This time he just repeats it with the legal backing and sanction to tell the world what he thinks about this person. Let them pay 100, 200 rand and get going so they're not in the system anymore. So there's a whole lot of things we're doing also to try and take out the less serious cases out of the system so the system can deal with the important cases. The fourth recommendation, which is probably one of the major recommendations, is around capacity building. I've already told you that I think we have huge problems and we've probably not always followed the right priorities, policies, and always the right resource allocation. If you look at that chart, in the left, I've tried to indicate this year the number of the crime that we've had this year. There were about 2 million cases reported. The police tell us 664 of those are for contact crimes. You look at the list, there's 18,000 murders, 18 attempted murders, aggravated robbery, and so on. And 500,000 property crimes. Now, in this given year, those are the new crimes that come on the scene. Plus, of course, we don't know how many crimes come over from the last part of it. But to deal with that, we only have 2,082 experts to collect evidence, forensic evidence. On. It's gone up a bit since last year. You can see it's about 400 people more. The experts we have to analyze is about 1,000 or so. Then we have a whole different forensic unit from the police, which is in health. They deal with blood alcohol and with toxicology. There are huge backlogs there. Some of the backlogs, they tell me, will take 10 years to wipe out, particularly in toxicology. But their staff capacity, as you can see there, is 54 for the whole country. Then the number of detectives to actually investigate crime. Now, these detectives include all your detectives dealing with organized crime and with commercial crime. We only have 21,724 in the country. Do the math. Divide them into the amount of new crimes and crimes coming over from it. Then you'll see why we have difficulty. This is only about 16% of your whole police force is are detectives. And then now you'll see the capacity of the legal aid board, the MPA, and the courts, which you can look at for yourself. Now our suggestion here is that as
far as forensic investigations are concerned, we have to substantially increase the number of crime scenes experts and forensic experts in SAPS and in Department of Health, with concomitant increase in facilities and equipment. For example, at this stage, you'll find that 3 people share a computer. In some instances, about 5 to 7 people share a cell phone. So when you're investigating crime, you know, you're on duty really for 24 hours a day. So you can imagine if you number 5 in the queue for the cell phone, and they're trying to phone Johnny DeLange, but Yunus Karim's got the phone today. And he says, "Hello, I'm a witness in your case." He says, "Okay, but sorry, the phone's not available now. It's my time to use the phone, but I'll pass on your message to Johnny, and I'll tell him that you called." It's literally as ridiculous as that, that you do not have the tools to do that. So then to try and retain the skills, obviously most of these people in forensics have BSc skills and so on. They're very sought after. So as soon as they come good, they all leave. So to try and retain those skills and make it better, we are looking at an OSD, which is an occupational specific dispensation for forensic experts. So we can try. And how these work, of course, is you load, as you stay longer in the system, the better your compensation gets, but much better than would be usual for in the civil service. So that the longer they stay, the more chance you have of retaining those skills. And then, of course, we need increase in appropriate training. Around detectives, we want to discuss with the detectives many issues that need to be adapted as far as their training is concerned. For all policemen, your training is 2 years. Doesn't matter whether you previously had forensic skills and that, you still do a 2-year training course. It doesn't matter. You go on before you become police. So we want to look at some changes there. Then we have suggested that we have to substantially increase the number of detectives from the present 15% to at least 1/3 of the police force. In other words, we want to double the number of detectives. And we hopefully want to do that at least by within a year or so. You can imagine it's difficult. Some of the issues we're looking at is to debate very strongly, and we're going to need everyone here to be part of this process, is to suggest that 10% of your present posts in the police force should be converted into detective posts. And then you go through a process of filling those posts. So immediately you can move from 15% to 25% with the present resources you have. Secondly, we're suggesting that only 1/3 of the new intake every year goes to detectives, that at least 2/3 of that intake should go to detectives. Then, of course, the coming budget, we will see how much we get more. And then, of course, lastly, to get to the 1/3, we will have to go to Treasury and top up to the 1/3. And we hope to do all this at least by sometime next year. Of course, you also then have to increase your facilities with that. To get double the staff, you need double the accommodation, you need double everything. So it's a huge, huge shift in priorities and reallocation of resources that is necessary. But if we all agree that that is the main priority for fighting crime, if once we get to that decision, then it should not be difficult to make these details and decisions. And then retention of skills, we're again looking at a very strong OSD for detectives. Occupational specific dispensation, they're busy drafting it, and obviously the training. And then also, I've already told you, these screening posts and so on, we want to create a whole lot of extra posts. The organized crime fighting capacity, it's obviously, and all of us know that it has increased as various crimes are linked to organized crimes, and we require a dedicated focus on organized crime in the CJS. Obviously, when this report was drafted originally, the present debates and decisions are taking place have not consolidated to the way they have now. And obviously in our original review, we went into generally looking at detectives. We haven't looked at specifically the specific units of it. But we will have to now, when this process has been finalized, we will have to clearly engage with a proper strategy for fighting organized crime and the proper systems and structures that are needed. We have a similar situation with white-collar and commercial crime. It's something we neglect hugely. I had a discussion the other day with SARS, Pravin Gordhan, and you'll find that there are 4,000 or 5,000 outstanding cases that have just not been dealt with for tax fraud and so on. So we're not doing very well on white-collar crime. We don't have a specific focus on it. And then one of the things that have been missing in most of our crime fighting is crime intelligence. They have not been structured in a way to actually help us fight crime, in my view. They have now, since May, come up with a new structure with new numbers and so on. For obvious reasons, I'm not showing you here what it is, because it's obviously sensitive. But the structure is there, and it fits in much more with what we are doing now in the review, that they will be there as a backup and a source for the detectives to identify criminals and help the detectives find evidence to put those criminals away. The prosecuting service and the rest I'm not going to discuss, because the only problem with prosecutors is a huge vacancy at the moment. It's down to 17, it was 24%. But obviously with justice and NPA and so on, as we go along and we make these changes, clearly we're going to have to create much more capacity in the courts and the prosecuting authority. So I'm not going into all that detail. The fifth recommendation I've basically discussed, what we've asked all the people that collect statistics in the criminal justice system are now in a task team, and they're busy drafting a single national template of all the criminal justice information we want. And also to create a system where we will use one number through the system. So that is on in a work in progress. They're sitting down, they're doing that. Once we've got that agreed to in cabinet and they start implementing it, then we will create, and the criminal justice system structure, we will create that national database that pulls all this information up and then analyzes it and gives us all credible information of what we have. So those are the steps we're putting in place to create this one national database. As far as our modernization systems are concerned, this is something you should actually look at. I mean, our departments have amazing modernization systems. The problem is, they have not prioritized them. So you go to Treasury all the time and say, give me $5 million for a pilot project in this, give me five. So you've got hundreds of pilot projects going, you've got no single IT system. So we've sat down with them, with what is called the IJS board, that have dealt with this matter now for years and not come up with a solution. And we've said, okay, what are all your projects? We've identified a few of them and said, okay, these are your core projects. Go away, draft a business plan to put these core, so we have a core criminal justice IT system in place. We'll go to cabinet with that and get agreement, and if there's money needed, add it to that, so that at least within a short time we have a core system. Then we can start looking at all these add-ons. At the moment, we're flooded by add-ons, and we don't have a system. I mean, the Deputy President the other day said, but you know, I've sat now in this cabinet for 14 years. I've heard for 14 years we're trying to get a single IT system for the criminal justice. Why don't we get it? Well, the answer is we don't get it because departments, your IT systems in departments are usually supportive. So the police will just add, justice will add, NPA will add projects, but no one actually looks at, can we get a single system and then add it onto that. So we've now given them that task. Hopefully we'll start moving now on this issue. But it will still be good if you're going to look at some of these systems are amazing and will modernize things tremendously. And then the last recommendation is something you've dealt with a lot, and that is to expand the role of civil society within the criminal justice system. You can do all these things. If we do not get it into the heads of our people that a lot of the crime, for example, things that are stolen and then sold and bought, are actually through our own people, and if we do not get it in our people's minds that it's right to impimpy on criminals, then clearly a lot of these things are not that good. But as you know already, we're looking at fundamental changes in the community police forums to expand their roles, but also to give them an independent existence, so that they act independently of the police in their areas and become a real accountability mechanism, not as now. And there can be a whole lot of other things that one can look at there. In the end, just to say, Chair, I thank you for listening to all this, because obviously this is a huge thing, to try and change the whole criminal justice system. I mean, I've not done even justice in this input. One can really sit here and talk for ages about it. But the thing is, yeah, you don't, but you know there's a good plan, and then you weet dinge gaan reg gemaak word, ek is nie as klap met die goed nie. For those that don't understand German, that I've just said to him, they're afraid of us actually succeeding because they'll know there's nothing to fight about then. But I do think is that, I'll just give xenophobia to you, Mrs. Conabon. So what we're trying to do this, and it's going to be a long process, some of it can be done quickly, some of it medium, some long term, is to really professionalize our law enforcement agencies and to increase the quality of the work tremendously of what it is now. And there's a lot of things. All these things will have to kick in to do that. And I really trust and hope that that Parliament will be on board in these processes, that it's not just a report given now and then in 2 years' time somewhere again. I really think that we should keep engaging, keep looking how we're moving on this. Are the departments actually dealing with these issues? Are they dealing in line? And then our priorities. I mean, if we work out and see that our priority is that we are just do not have good capacity and quality capacity to actually find criminals, to find evidence and put them away, then clearly that needs to be a major priority. And I think a lot of this, these steps that we've taken are actually to deal with that. So I thank you once again, Chair.
The co-chairs, we feel it's a very useful, very comprehensive input. And we should take a discussion of some sort now. But procedurally, I think what might also be useful, it's the first time it's come into the public domain in that comprehensive form. What I think we need to do is before we pass these bills, because the bills are linked to the overall overhaul, that we invite the Deputy Minister and his team back. So sometime when we come back from the provincial public hearings, and as we process the two bills before us, I think, Johnny, we invite you back and your team so that we have a more comprehensive exchange. In the meanwhile, it might be useful for different committee, different parties here to make written submissions, and those of you here from the public, in response to what the Deputy Minister has said, we can start doing written submissions, because the aim is to feed into the Cabinet process via Parliament and these public hearings the views of the public and political parties. It's long overdue. It's here now. Let's do it. So let's hand over. Before people ask questions, can we also, the co-chair asked me to raise this, alert those of you who are here for the public hearings to be very clear that you will have exactly the time allocated to you. In fact, what has happened is one or two stakeholders, for reasons beyond their control, will not be able to appear this afternoon, and we have to juggle the program around. But we'll be clearer as we get to lunchtime. Finally, DASA and the Helen Suzman Foundation, if you are here, the two chairs would like to meet with you at lunchtime. But what we are saying to people, not to worry, you'll have plenty of time for those of you here for the public hearings. Over then to members.
The typing is too small. I find it very difficult to read much of this. Yes, it's an excellent attempt by Johnny, but I can't read some of it, especially those... I can't read it.
It's Len, Dr. Delpot, and Ms. Colabana.
Thank you, Chair. I wish to thank the Deputy Minister for a very, very interesting and honest admission of the dysfunctional justice system. I think it's only when you acknowledge the problems, and I see he's acknowledged most of the problems, that you can solve them. And the recommendations make much sense to us. Thank you for that. But I fail to see, Deputy Minister, this decision by the Cabinet was taken on the 7th of November, if I remember correctly. That is before Polokwane, and I also fail to see in your input how this affects the scorpions or the removal of the scorpions. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I am interested that the two bills before us have absolutely nothing to do with the presentation that we've heard, as long overdue as it is, and thank you for it at last. The bills address the one subject, the dissolution of the DSO, and indeed, when Cabinet approved this review, as we just heard in November, at the seven principles on which it was based, the dissolution of the scorpions was not in there. And you, in fact, sir, went to the Polokwane conference and argued against the dissolution of scorpions. It seems you lost that argument to the people in Polokwane, who I don't know if there are any of them here in Parliament, perhaps a few. I presume you're going to try and retroactively include the dissolution of the scorpions into this review process. Perhaps you are the one person, because a lot have tried rather feebly and failed, who could give us some sort of cogent reason what we will achieve by scrapping the Scorpions, in fact shoving this unit underneath the very man they've been investigating, whose contract of course has been extended.
Thank you, Chair, and again, thank you, Deputy Minister, for the frank discussion. You recall I was with you in PE, and I just wanted to touch on the one aspect that we found there, the integrated justice system there operating. That's not the engine room, and you spoke about national, provincial, and local level, and that particular room there where you had the various elements there, the police, the court officials, social workers, correctional services, is that envisaged on a national level as well, because that was very effective at that level. And then I'm also very pleased that at long last we're talking about binding protocols between departments. You remember, I think it was Mike Masuta that raised that many years ago. It's a pity it's taken so long, but we appreciate that. Just then, on touching on some of the previous questions, you did say that a proper strategy for fighting organized crime is needed, and obviously that's the million-dollar question, whether if that strategy is needed, why we are going ahead with the disbanding of the Scorpions. Surely we need to look at that strategy holistically as well, and what impact that will have, if you'd comment on that. Thank you so much, Chair.
Sir Person, I think the problem here is that when people are supposed to see the forest, they decide to see the trees. I think that's the main problem here, because most of these people from all these parties, we have been with them in the committee, and they know that the advert said, first we must deal with the review of the criminal justice system, then we deal with the NPA and the SAPS amendment bill. Because even Judge Kambembe raised the problem of coordination and integration, and this is what Comrade Joni has been raising. So I don't really see the logic of some of these questions, and I don't think they are fair on the Deputy Minister. I really think that people are just here for politicking. There are submissions, people who want to make inputs here. So if these people have mobilized people and they are now afraid of facing us in this committee, they must say that. We are prepared for them.
As you well know, people can post questions on their contributions. And that's a contribution. And we'll have Bruno Walter and Chris.
Thank you, Chairperson. It seems that there's some other members who wants to be the Chairperson.
Yeah.
But besides that, Chairperson, this is not the first time we have a program or a plan on the criminal justice system. In fact, in the late 90s, we also had a review on the criminal justice system. So this is the second one. And what is important, it's very good things that is said in this review. But the proof, as they say, lies in the eating of the pudding. And I'd like to ask the Honourable Deputy Minister, what time frame are we talking about for the implementation of this review? Is there an indication, because, he's still blaming apartheid even after 14 years, but if he can just give us a more or less a time frame of this review, please.
So then, yes. Thank you.
Yeah. I agree that we should confine ourselves actually to the Scorpion issue, but I want to congratulate the Honourable Deputy Minister on what appears to be an excellent document. But I didn't hear anything about the Supreme Court, the High Court. And I wonder if the Deputy Minister wouldn't look into the Pretoria High Court, where these days you wait longer than 2 years to get a case heard. You wait longer than 6 months to tax a bill. And some judgments are outstanding for a year or two or three. This matter has been brought to the attention of the Judicial Service Commission, but it doesn't appear to have much progress. Also, and this is a very sad picture, you cannot find find out which judgments are outstanding in that Pretoria High Court. The judge president writes to the Law Society and say, can't you find out from your members how many judgments are outstanding that they're waiting on? Apparently they don't have a computer system, which is very simple. The moment you issue a notice of motion or a judge or a dagvaarding, a summons, they put it on the computer and then you follow it. So then, on a monthly basis, the JP will know how many judgments are outstanding, which judges, and they can call them in and skop 'n bietjie gat.
Imam, and then that's it. We have to move on. Remember, we're going to bring you back, Deputy Minister, and committee members. I think also, can we also suggest, Co-Chair, that we should bring in the other committees as well, meaning correctional services, home affairs and so on, that belong to the cluster the next time you are here within the next 6 weeks. So it's Dr. Delport and Imam, and that's it for now.
Chairperson, shortly after I agreed in Parliament one day with the President, he lost his election, so I'm not going to agree with Mr. De Lange, because I think the Deputy Minister is the one man that can make this new envisaged system work. He alluded to one problem, though, that in his presentation there's no indication of how we are going to deal with it. One, he called it laziness. It's not merely laziness, it's a lack of commitment. And it's a lack of discipline. And that is one of our core problems. There's no discipline, or not adequate discipline in the police, and there's not adequate discipline in our whole court system. Nobody is nowadays the boss anymore who can call up prosecutors and tell them, I want this and that done. And even interpreters are sometimes even not there. They don't turn up, and who will take them to task? Are they responsible? So I want to make an honest plea to the Deputy Minister that some mechanism must be felt to really, again, instill discipline in the role players within the broad system.
Thank you, Chairperson. Deputy Minister, in the review, you've mentioned a number of administrative structures and procedures in order to bring about, you know, this transformation in the criminal justice system. Right? Certainly, it cannot be done only by administrative procedures. It has to be done also by the introduction of legislation here. Right? And I take it that this legislation on the table is part of that. Do you foresee any other piece of legislation going to be introduced in order to effect this transformation of the criminal justice system? Secondly, in your recommendation 2, this advisory board, yeah, I'm a bit worried about that one. This advisory board, right, that's going to participate in this whole process also includes the judiciary and the magistracy. Haven't we got a problem there, Deputy Chairperson, of conflict of interest? Or of separation of powers.
That's it. Can I just ask a question also, Deputy Minister? My understanding of this review is that absolutely every structure within the criminal justice system is being reviewed. It means the organized crime unit within the SAPS. It means the DSO. I can't see why the DSO should not be reviewed. Also, is it not the norm in most democracies that over a period, especially around challenging issues like crime, given, you know, new emergence of new forms and new trends in crime, given what we call now globalized crime, which we didn't have 10 years ago, it's perfectly normal for a democracy, for a government and a parliament to review all of its structures in the criminal justice system. We do it in respect of other policies, housing and so on. What is so unique about the DSO that it's immune from any review whatsoever? And isn't it inevitable if you were going to, and if you are going to overhaul the criminal justice system, that you will in fact look at the DSO, but you'll also look at a whole lot of other, in fact every other. Otherwise, how can you call it an overhaul of the entire criminal justice system?
I thank you all
for the questions. I hope that as we go ahead and engage further on these issues, that I'm just saying, as we go ahead on it, that we will start engaging with these things on their merits and not try and make them coming. People have to justify why they're here, and so I mean, I've got no problem if people want to raise those issues. But I do trust that as we go ahead, that you will start engaging with these matters. Because this attempt is a genuine attempt to try, firstly, as Mr. Hubert has pointed out, that government has very honestly looked at the system and identified real weaknesses and dysfunctionalities. Now that it's done so, it's on the table for all of us to engage with. No one can again say they did not know that these problems existed. And I hope that in doing so that we engage on these things properly and we find the right solutions. Maybe some of the suggestions we're making may not actually deal with the problem exactly, and maybe there's a better solution to it. So I would say that we should do that. Whether you do it as part of the Scorpion's decision that has to be made, where you do it, we in any case are going to go on with the review. All that this Scorpion's issue does give us the possibility of doing is engaging on the specifics of strategies around particular crimes. For example, we were met with National Treasury and the MPA the other day, and we've identified that we do not necessarily have good and solid and thoroughgoing policies on how we're going to tackle the issue of white-collar crime. I mean, if you want to look at problems, go and look at white-collar crime. Look at what's happening in our economy, how we're being mocked at every turn. But in the criminal justice system, in the MPA, as I know the MPA, there is just not the capacity to actually deal with organized crime, white-collar crime, on a continuous basis. I mean, just in government, SARS came and showed us a list of all their cases that are outstanding. The Financial Services Board came and showed us. In each case, it's thousands and hundreds of cases of a very technical, commercial nature. Now, to create prosecutors and detectives to have the skills to deal with commercial or organized crime things, it takes a lifetime. You don't just wake up one day and say to a prosecutor, walk in and go and deal with these things. So, our bigger problem has to be when we looked at the results in the courts, that we are dysfunctional in many ways and we have to deal and capacitate and professionalize and make accountable our people that investigate crime. Whether they investigate it in the police or in Scorpions, wherever they do it, the review would cover all those things in time to come. As you see, we've got their strategy for organized crime, a strategy for commercial crime, because those are two specific detective units that exist at the moment and structures. So, you know, I know for politicking reasons you have to say what you're saying, but I hope that when we get over that and you take the attitude that Dr. Dalport has taken, that we have to engage with these things to fix it up for our people. I don't find it acceptable that our regional courts are only finishing 6 cases on average a month. I find it completely and utterly wrong. But I don't blame the regional courts presidents for it. It's the system that's dysfunctional. It starts with investigations, it starts with prosecution, it starts everywhere. We don't collect forensic evidence, so we can't back up people's evidence in courts and so on. And this problem exists across the board, whether it's organized crime, whether it's commercial crime, whether it's across the board. And the problem is, we are just do not have a pool of investigators that firstly are enough and do the kind of quality work that we do, whether it's organized crime, commercial, or the other things. So I'm not going to argue with you whether you think it should be here or not should be and how this fits into it. The issue is, we're putting this issue on the table. Government has chosen that we look at all changes in the criminal justice system holistically within this overview, and we will continue doing that. And if you make and try and please make some positive contributions to make this thing work, we will welcome that. I think the issue you raised, Dr. Delport, of discipline, I call it accountability. I think if you look at our criminal justice system, there's no accountability. No one pays a price for not doing what they should do. No one pays a price. If you say, why has this case actually not worked, then the detectives will blame the prosecutors will blame the detectives, etc. What are we doing here? We are here trying to create a system that is based on rational systems and things that will hold people accountable, like the screening mechanism. Now that we have the screening mechanism, when we've created it, clearly cases that go into court are only going to be trial ready. So a whole lot of problems then get back to the detectives. The detectives can't dump their dockets in courts anymore because they have to meet some kind of performance arrangements. So I think through those things, and if you look at the protocols we're drafting, each protocol ends off with the following. We, the cabinet, hereby agree to this protocol, and all members of government will be bound in their employment, and bound by it, and it will become part of their conditions of employment, and therefore not complying with this protocol could lead to disciplinary steps. So what we're doing is trying to take all these touch points where we don't have accountable mechanisms and try to create accountable mechanisms so that we can hold people to account to it. The issue of whether we're going to put it in legislation, I think that one day when the system, you know, we're only a 13 years old democracy, I think one day when the system starts working and we're happy with it, I personally would like to see that it's turned into legislation, that it becomes part of the DNA of how we fight crime. So it's not something you can just do away with, that it becomes part of legislation, that it becomes part of accountability, it becomes part of oversight. But I think we need to just get it down the line a bit. So there'll be a whole lot of protocols. I've already said there'll be an overall criminal justice protocol. There'll be one on court. We're creating protocols on forensics, protocols on bail, et cetera, to start binding people into the system and making them accountable to the system. The advisory board, you shouldn't worry about. Its name says everything. It's an advisory board. It advises. It tells you what the problems are. But we feel that it is important. If you look at England, you'll find it works very well there. I don't know if you went on that trip to England, you people looked at that. But in England, the judges very happily sit on these boards and so on because they've got a stake in it. Because they sit in court and they have to deal with a lot of these problems and so on. So in a lot of cases, all that they're doing in these cases, you're not sitting there saying, what judgments are you giving? You're dealing about administration here and coordination. So clearly judges have to be part of it. They're the pinnacle of judicial sanction in our system. They're the strongest people that can actually implement and force down things. So we need to hear their views as well in such a structure. The time frame is yesterday. The time frame is yesterday. As soon as we were appointed and the structure is working now, if you look at another slide there, I didn't show it to you, but it had all the task teams that are working at the moment. We've got groups, at least, I don't know, it's about 7, 8, 9, 10 task teams. We're not doing one at this. Look at all of them. We've created a task team around human resource development. They must go and look at OSDs for us on how we have to restructure the detectives, what will we do with organized crime, commercial crime, etc. Then you've got a structure that looks at all those stats and the national database. They're sitting, and now they're meeting. As we get reports from them, we'll take them to cabinet, discuss it with cabinet. When they approve it, clearly that will then become the norm, and that's how we'll operate. Now, so obviously we're actually trying to fix up all those task teams that we're working with now. We'll try and fix up everything. We're working on everything now to take through as many of the proposed changes as possible. Some of it's going to be quick. You can think for yourself. You know how government works. If you have to start changing detectives from 15, say, to 30% detectives, I mean, you know how big problem that is. You know how much admin is going to take. You know how much politicking is going to take. Huge amount of stuff. But, I mean, if we don't do it in a short period of time, we'll lose the momentum. We'll lose all the political buy-in. Remember, these are all things that have been approved by cabinet, the 7 main points. And we've got that buy-in at the moment. And so it's for us now to find the right things and then to push it as far. And so I hope that we will at least in the next month or two start agreeing on some things already and implement them. For example, a court protocol to let courts start working differently. At a regional court level, we should try and implement that very quickly. District courts will take a bit longer for us to do so and so. And the Legal Aid Board is very important in that, because if 85% of your cases are dealt by, they need the resources to have enough lawyers to be able to do those type of things. Honourable Funamaba, look, I think we've not concentrated a lot in criminal matters on the High Court, because if you look at the numbers, the High Courts do very little. I think on average they do about 2,000 criminal cases a year. Now I know that, and that's what I'm going to come to and say, that obviously we've not looked at the civil law, but we are planning as a department, well, probably time will run out, but one of the big things that still has to be done is for us to start a whole review of the civil justice system. Because there, of course, that is driven more by money and by private interests. And there the poor definitely are left behind all the time. But, you know, we've got a lot of things on our plate at the moment. That is another issue, the civil law, that has to come through. For all of you that don't read well, you can speak to... This is a public document now. They can give you the emailer to everyone, and they can look at it. Of course, shouldn't have got that one before everyone else, but we can definitely edit it. So as I said, I'm not going to get into petty fights here about whether this is about the DSO. Of course it's about the DSO. You're going to have hearings about the DSO. You're going to discuss it. We're going to have to discuss it in our parties. But let's try and do whatever the decision is going to be. Let's try and look at it in the context of what we want this criminal justice system to do. I mean, whether we fight organized crime in this structure or in that structure, we need a proper strategy to fight those. Because once those things get a foothold, and they're getting more and more of a foothold in our country, you don't then get rid of them. I mean, you know, how do you get rid of the mafia? You don't get rid of them anymore. They're part of the furniture in the United States. And it's because over decades we've allowed that to happen. So whatever we do about these things, we're still going to have to find the right strategies to fight these things at different levels. And I think this just gives us a chance to engage and try and do it much more at a level that is actually going to mean something to our people. Ultimately, what we get out of it, than just to narrowly focus on a particular thing, which in any case we would have dealt with as we went along. I think that answers most of the questions.
Yeah, I think that answers them. Just very quickly, we need to continue this exchange between the executive and parliament. So what we will seek to do, the two chairs, is facilitate a meeting within the next 4 to 5 weeks with all the relevant committees. Secondly, I think that from justice's side, many of us have felt, as you know, Deputy Minister, that the process is too tardy. It's going too slow. Cabinet came out in November last year and set out these principles. We had understood that the President will set it out in the State of Nation Address, and the Minister's concern and Deputy Minister's concern, not least yourself, will spell it out in greater detail in your press and other briefings immediately after the State of Nation Address. And, of course, that didn't happen to the extent we had hoped. Nevertheless, we're pleased now that it's formalized and you're responsible for it, and we have somebody to hold to account, and also that it's now in the public domain. So in short, we should stop carping now. What we have to do, time frames have been raised to you. In fact, you said yesterday, which is an excellent answer. But Parliament and the public, together, we have a responsibility to put pressure on the executive to deliver speedily. So in short, let's move forward. Let's write a report that emerges from our exchanges around this, and actually let ourselves, between now and at least March next year, whenever the elections are being held, set down some guidelines by which we would like to see progress and actually bring you and your department before the cluster to monitor progress in that regard. Having said that, can we move then to the NPA? I should, by the way, on behalf of the two of us, welcome also the NCOP committees are here. Mr. Sikelo Sijeka is here from one of the committees that's relevant. Welcome. And Hoshi Mokwena is here somewhere, and members of their committee. Over then to the NPA. Who's introducing the NPA? The Deputy Minister is not well. We weren't sure he was going to come until we saw him here, and we wish him a full recovery speedily. Thank you. Is it Yuan? Sure. Let members to the files that you've got. We have got documents. There's one file that has, of course,
the bills, and it has the programs both for our public hearings here nationally and provincially. The other file has all the research work done. There's a summary of all the submissions we've received. There is a summary of the bills, the two bills. There is a summary of the Kampepe Commission. There is a summary of various other research pieces relevant to the processing of the bill. So members will have time over the next 2 weeks to read that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Co-Chairperson, for the opportunity to present. Just on the point that the Deputy Minister raised on his presentation and in response to your comment about the speed with which the review ought to be done, I noted that it was not in the Deputy Minister's input, but I must advise the members here that some of the changes and the recommendations that have been identified are in the process of implementation already, because part of the review is that those items that are identified that can be implemented as work in progress continues can be implemented, so some of that can be done. So I think next time the Deputy Minister is able to present his report, we'll include some of that work. On that note, Chair, I'd like to start on the National Prosecution Authority Amendment Bill. Mr. Jan Delange here on my left, no relation to the deal, will present the clauses in the bill. I am going to present the background and introduce the method because I've been involved with it. The first point that I'd like to make is that this forms part of the review of the criminal justice system. So it is part and parcel of the work that the Deputy Minister is coordinating of the review of the criminal justice system. So all of this must be looked together. In fact, there is another link of the review of the criminal justice system which we omitted to put in the presentation by the Deputy Minister, and that deals with the legal research on quite a number of issues. For example, you know, the system in South Africa is one of adversarial nature, where the parties basically contest, and there have been questions about the usefulness or the continued use of that approach with respect to the legal system that exists, and there have been views that say that the system must surely be at least inquisitorial to a large extent to enable the judiciary to also descend into the arena, as it were, and engage with the parties. And also it has arisen in the context of cases involving children, that sometimes when children give testimony, it is not always the best way to allow the adversarial system to work against them, such that they are questioned by the parties in that way. So the system has to be inquisitorial to some extent to enable, again, the judiciary to assist and create some element of flexibility. So there's an element of legal research that is being done that looks at the whole system of the criminal justice system, as it were. And so that part is going to be much longer than the one the Deputy Minister described, because it's quite detailed issues, and a lot of consultation with the judiciary in particular will have to come to play. On this particular issue, first I want to just remind members that what drives the executive's work is its program of action. The program of action of government is one that dictates what work the various clusters and the various departments in government have to do at any point in time. And the JCPS cluster is also driven by a program of action. And this program of action talks to a number of issues, some of which are the following: that the government must reduce crime by between 7 to 10% per annum. What also there is that there must be the transformation of the judiciary, also that there must be the effectiveness of the criminal justice system, just to name those three. And in each one of these key activities, there are a large number of sub-programs that seek to achieve each one of those. And just to deal with the issue of the effectiveness of the criminal justice system, we've got the question there of awaiting trial detainees, how issues of bail process and alternative sentencing come into play. We're dealing with the issues of children in conflict with the law. The Justice Committee recently passed the Child Justice Bill, which talks to how the criminal justice system was dealing with the issue of trade and conflict with the law in the past, and now this new bill takes them out. There are issues of case law management, dealing with court case roles that the minister described with the judiciary. There's an issue of case backlog. There's an issue of coordination of activities by law enforcement structures of government in the various departments. And the issue of coordination of activities of law enforcement agencies is linked to the issue of reduction of crime. So there are structures that are in place in government that deal with how the program of action can be given effect to and what each structure within the within each department plays a role in this respect. On the issue of reducing crime, again, it's broken down into a number of various crimes. There's a question of ATM bombings that the Joint Committee, which is a structure that includes the, you know, the police, the NPA, NIA, and other intelligence agencies, how to deal with the issue of ATM bombings. There's house breaking, and there's cash in transit, and there's general corruption. So within the cluster, different structures are in place to try and respond to the program of action, as it were. So the question has always been, and will is now, and possibly will continue to always be, how to ensure maximum and efficient utilization of resources of government in order to achieve the objectives of the program of action, and also how to ensure that at all times there is appropriate coordination between these various structures in order to achieve the objectives of government, because these are really the sine qua non issues that will determine whether or not there is the relevant integration. On the issue of coordination specifically, Chair, we've observed over a long period of time that in the cluster, that when we look and we're starting to measure the activities of the program of action and the progress reports that we submit, it's become very clear to us that there are areas where we're not achieving the objectives as much as we would want, largely because there's lack of coordination, or at least effective coordination, and the issue of resources is not always so best. So when we look at all of these issues, we then say, how do we start responding to these particular issues? We then say, let's look at what we have currently. One of the first challenges that we've noted is that we have a proliferation of law enforcement agencies. In other words, in response by government to the challenges that face government at this point in time and the South African community at this point in time, government through various departments has responded by putting in place what it believes at that point in time are structures that are best placed to deal with that particular problem. And as a result, in the area of law enforcement, we've put up agencies. And when you look at what these agencies do, you realize that there's a proliferation. Just to mention a few, we've got the SAPs, which, you know, deal with general investigation of all levels of crime. We have the immigration branch in Home Affairs. We have the customs units in SARS that deals with, you know, customs-related issues and tax-related issues. We have FICA, which deals with financial transactions that do not comply with the relevant legislation. We have the DSO, about which we'll hear more during these processes. We have the SIU, which deals with public corruption. We have the Green Scorpion, which deals with the protection of the environment. Now, if you look from a law enforcement perspective and on the criminal side with this problem with breaking the law, we have those structures. And if you look at what they do, a large part of their work overlaps. In many ways, a large part of their work overlaps within the specific areas in which they are assigned to work, obviously. But largely, they are overlaps. Now, this particular situation is absolutely not different to economic regulation. It's not different to economic regulation. What do you have on the economic regulation? Just to draw parallel, we have economic regulators that look at the regulation of the economy. We have the Financial Services Board, we have the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal, we have the CASA, we have NESA. All of them look at the specific areas to which they've been assigned. But the overall thrust that holds them is sound financial economic regulation. Sound economic regulation. You can even break them further and say, in the area of banking, what is there in the area
financial, sound financial system. On competition regulation, we have ICASA, we have NERSA, we have the competition authorities, all looking at one thing, but within the different areas. So even there, on the area of economic regulation, when you look at economic regulators, you know, it's been argued many times and it's still part of ongoing debates whether or not you don't have a proliferation on that side. Why am I raising the issue of proliferation? It is because in the cause of enforcement, there are different interests that arise. There are different interests that arise because each regulator will look at their own areas of work from a narrow perspective. From a narrow perspective. And sometimes that approach does remove us from looking at the bigger picture, which is the broader economic regulation of issues. Same thing applies in law enforcement. Now, what is the purpose of regulation? The purpose of regulation is to ensure investment, encourage investment, ensure that there's stability in the economic environment, predictability of the regulated economic environment. There must be certainty. There must be sound financial system. Now, are those expectations and those basis for regulation any different with law enforcement in the manner that you look at it from a criminal perspective? There must be certainty. There must be stability. There must be predictability in the system. All for purposes of ensuring that there's a sound environment within which people operate in South Africa to attract the very same investment. I'm drawing these parallels deliberately to show that there's nothing unique in what is being discussed here. There's absolutely nothing unique in being discussed. This is the same as any other discussion that's taking place elsewhere in the Republic. The most important thing in both these, whether it's law enforcement agencies' work or economic regulation, are two key things. Coordination and cooperation. Those are the two most important things. Because when you have different bodies doing the same kind of work, depending on the same type of resources, you need to have an environment that ensures that they work together in a manner that each one of them is able to achieve the objectives, because within the objectives that they achieve amongst themselves, there is a greater objective to which all of them are expected to operate it and deliver on. And that is the question of interdependence. All of them are interdependent. None of these structures functions in a vacuum on their own. They're interdependent because the common objective is sound economic regulation or law enforcement in the Republic. Now, when I deal specifically with the activities of law enforcement, law enforcement, as the Deputy Minister described in the review, is really largely about dealing with crimes or non-compliance with laws that would have happened, and it largely centers around investigation. Somebody has to investigate it to establish whether factually there has been non-compliance or there has been a crime committed, so that following from that investigation there is a prosecution, and hopefully the outcome of that prosecution results in a deterrent effect on any other person who's committed a crime. That's really the ultimate. We centered on one simple thing: conduct soft investigations, so that the outcome of those investigations enables us to prosecute effectively, and if we succeed in those prosecutions, as we would expect to be with a thorough investigation, we will then have a deterrent effect on everybody else, because everybody will know that there will be an investigation and there will be a prosecution, and if there's a successful prosecution, whatever the outcome the court gives doesn't really matter, because there will be some punishment. But there will be a deterrent effect in that you know you're going to get caught, you're going to be dealt with, and so forth and so forth. Now, what does an investigation depend on? That is the interdependence I was talking about, because nobody can do everything by themselves, and nobody should do everything by themselves, simply because it just doesn't work that way on the ground. Now, an investigation, depending on the nature of the issues, will involve, as you know, evidence gathering, the most important aspect that the Deputy Minister spoke about, which would also involve intelligence. And in this country, for purposes of intelligence, there are structures that are, in terms of relevant legislation, expected to provide the information to all other law enforcement agencies. So law enforcement agencies, proliferated as the environment is, deal with more or less the same issues. Investigation of matters falling within their mandate for purposes of achieving a specific outcome. Now, what we should look at, and what we've looked at when you look at these progress reports, and we look at why in some cases you don't seem to be making the type of progress they want to make, the question to ask ourselves is, what happens when there's a breakdown in coordination? what happens when there's a breakdown in cooperation between law enforcement agencies in that type of environment? What happens when there is no more interdependence as there should be, when everybody does their own affairs, they deal with issues on their own? What you have is a number of things. One, you have unhealthy competition between law enforcement and authorities, because each one then focuses on how best they can best position themselves for whatever purposes. There's no need to cooperate with another. You have lawlessness, possibly because when you start working in that way, you know, you potentially can break the law. In some cases, the law is broken because the objective is to achieve what you can best achieve to the exclusion of others. You have lack of effectiveness because there's no more cooperation, there's no more coordination. So the interdependence is gone and there's lack of effectiveness. There's inefficiency because instead of dealing with resources in a manner that best maximizes them, each one focuses on their own resources, and duplications and triplications, as the case may be, obviously happen. There's lack of stability in an environment because, again, you know, there's no more that expectation of coordination. Everybody does their own thing, and there's no stability in the environment. Now, we are not certain what's going to happen next because, again, everybody's all over the place doing their own thing. There's lack of predictability. You can't predict, you know. The environment is supposed to be predictable. You commit a crime, there's going to be an investigation. You know, the processes must follow all the way to the ultimate end. But when you don't have cooperation and coordination between the relevant authorities, that predictability goes. You don't know what happens. You wait for the next moment. We have a problem of competing interests. We have a problem of competing interests because the focus is now on individuals, in this case, individual agents. If you start having all of those things that I've described amongst others, or any one of them, or a combination of them, and there's no way of dealing with them effectively, you don't achieve your objectives, your program of action, but the public interest which informs the whole of law enforcement starts getting undermined. The very same objective of ensuring that there's proper law enforcement to ensure a public interest, you start undermining that because your environment is no longer suitable. In some cases, you even start undermining national security. It's not always deliberate. It becomes an inadvertent outcome of the type of activities that should be happening in there. So the point I'm making in raising all of this is to show how we got to be sitting here. How we got to be sitting here, Chairperson, is that when we then look as a cluster on all of these issues, you know, specific to cases about which we already have knowledge and about the general work, when the stats tell us that relative to the investment that has been put, there isn't the output that you should be expecting, and you start analyzing these things, you start seeing that there are contributory factors. And some of these contributing factors are those that I've mentioned in just a few minutes ago: lawlessness, lack of effectiveness, lack of efficiency, misallocation of resources, and so forth. You start understanding why you are not achieving what you need to achieve, and you then have to sit and review and say, how do we get back on track? How do you get back on track so that we can achieve the objectives that you want to achieve? Now, the 8 points that I mentioned that one sees when there's lack of coordination and cooperation are exactly the type of points that we've seen between the South African Police Services and the TSO. We've definitely seen that, you know, in the way they've engaged with themselves and in the way we have observed in trying to deal with many of the issues that have arisen in there. So the point for us is, you know, how do you get back to the starting point of having an effective law enforcement framework in this country? Effective law enforcement framework that gives the public the confidence that crime as a government program is being dealt with properly, and that we're on course to reducing crime by between 7 to 10% in all its material respects. The question is that the executive and government in this case, in the form of this particular JCPS cluster, must be able to give those types of meaningful responses to those questions that the public will pose. Now, it's a question. The review is simply a question of policy choice. It's a question of policy informed by the various inputs that you know, the executive would have seen and observed. And based on the work that's been done, we have to make a choice. And part of the pardon me, between the government of the day, is how do you shape your framework? And you can start by shaping your framework by looking at the structure of your organs. I started by saying we have a proliferation. Part of the review and the change can be a look at the structure to say, what if we structured differently? We structured our law enforcement agencies differently. That's been part of the debate. And this one is just the beginning. So what is proposed is that there be established a new unit within the police services. A new unit between the police services that will deal with priority crimes, that will deal with organized crime of a special type, high-level organized crime, and that a new division be established. That is the whole point. You start with a structure. You say, which is the best way to deal with this? Based on everything we know, and based on everything that we've seen, that we've observed, we create a new division within the police. That is the proposal on the table, Chair, that this is the best way to respond to quite a number of the issues that I've dealt with. Obviously, there's further detail and facts to them. So, the SAPS being the organ of state that has the primary responsibility for fighting crime is the one that is being entrusted with the responsibility of dealing with these particular issues. The bill, as Johan will deal with going forward, will show how it is proposed, and Mr. Jacobs of the police later will show how the new division is going to be, or it is proposed to be created, which will respond to the challenge of crime that has been described. Everything that I've said in it, in whole, are the points that the Deputy Minister presented on earlier. Those points still apply exactly the same way to this particular environment. So this is a policy decision that says, structurally, this is how we want to organize. And that's a policy choice. Just as much as it was a policy choice to say, structurally, we're going to create a different agency. Now, how do we enhance the work of the police service? Structurally, you can, within, internally, expand, like it is proposed to create a new division, so you can restructure the police internally. So part of the review, Chair, is to look at the restructuring of the police itself internally, starting with the creation of this new division. The other policy option is, in addition to that, you have other law enforcement agencies on the side. You have other law enforcement agencies on the side to support the police services in the work that it does with its own specialist areas. So the reason why there's usually a lot of other agencies on the side to assist in a particular framework is to deal with some issues specifically of specialization. So this is really a policy choice that is informed by everything that we know that has been presented that deal with this. Questions have been asked about what is the reason for the decision taken. It's a policy choice informed by all of these particular considerations that seeks best to respond. Whether or not it's the most appropriate, whether it's the best under the circumstances, I think it's something that is exactly being debated. And that's why this forum is sitting here as it is, whether or not this is the best mechanism. But it is definitely informed by the issues that I've described. Eight of them that I've said arise when there's a lack of coordination and the lack of cooperation. Clearly the existing framework has not worked best in all of the circumstances. And it is the type of framework that, with some of its parts being good and having worked very well, it has certain parts that haven't worked well at all. In fact, have created a lot more problems. And when you consider these things as a whole, we have recommended that this is the most appropriate steps to take at this point in time, at this moment in our history, in order to avoid ongoing unpredictability and instability in the environment. Again, the executive is entitled to change this at any point in time in the future if it so wishes. But at this point in time, at this moment in our history, we're making this recommendation in order to make sure that we create the right environment that we want. So I'll allow Johan to tell you what the specific legislation around the NP Amendment Bill says, Chair, if you'll allow me, Johan.
Chairperson, may I, just on a point of procedure, can't we debate the principle first before going into the detail? Because I would like to do that.
Right, yeah. Okay, that's not a problem, because the concrete clauses are an expression of what the DG has said. Okay, then shall we have Dr. Delport and then Steve?
Chairperson, with all due respect to Mr. Similani, he's reminded me of a time in my previous life or career when I was trying to make a point with first year law students. And I referred them to a well-known dictum that said the judge must never descend into the arena because his vision will become clouded by the dust of the conflict. And in an exam, that a first-year student gave it back to me in the following form. A judge must never descend into the arena because he will cloud the issue by the dust of his vision. With all due respect, the presentation by the Deputy Minister started off by pointing out defects in the present system. Nowhere in his presentation has he pointed out defects as far as the DSO was concerned. Nowhere in Mr. Similani's presentation he points to defects. In fact, the problem is for the Director General that whatever he can put on the table in terms of facts would show that the DSO was busy doing a very good job. And instead of rectifying those points that could be criticized, it was deemed safer, and I will explain the term safer to remove the measure of independence that they had and place them under the Commissioner of Police. Now, the statement was made, this is an executive decision. It's a policy decision. If it was a policy decision, surely it was not. It was not propelled by the review of the criminal justice system. Because the criminal justice system and the review started years ago. And after it had started already, and after we heard some outlines of an approach, then came the decision to disband or to integrate the DSO with the SAPS. I am afraid to say that it was not driven, the executive decision was not driven by a quest to improve our criminal justice system, but it was driven by a quest to protect friends. And I make bold to say that the fruits will be reaped in future if you persist with this, with this ploy. Chairperson, nobody in this country really believes that what it is about is an improvement of the system. You don't try and fix something that's not broken. If there are defects, you remedy. In fact, the way in which they operated was on an integrated system. It was on a system where the prosecutors and the investigators worked hand in hand. Now we are saying we are striving towards an integrated system. But the one example that worked time that Parliament takes its job seriously. It may be a policy decision by the executive, but only Parliament can put it into effect and operation. And I want to call on Parliament, as the members in Parliament of all political parties, to stand up against this decision and show that Parliament caters for the needs of the people that we represent. Thank you, sir.
Can I just set the framework for what we're doing here, if it's not clear? We are actually getting an overview of the bill, and we are being taken briefly through the bill. We will, after the public hearings, have exhaustive exchanges. So, in the general sense that you're posing questions, it's fine, but we must have clear sort of sense that this is not the processing of the bill at this stage, it's an overview. And I also think that it's important that if ANC members are called on to be open-minded, the same applies to opposition members. So all sides, we have to be open-minded. There's no specific and special obligation on the majority party members to be open-minded about the decision that comes from Polokwane. On the other hand, there is just as much an obligation on the opposition parties also to keep an open mind. The second thing to say is that, you see, we shouldn't have an endless discussion about precisely what the relationship is between the DSO bills and the criminal justice systems in terms of chronology, when exactly, and so on. Kola Barnard raised the question. Ultimately, even if it were established that the DSO was like an add-on as part of a review of the criminal justice system late last year, early this year, the responsibility on us, whatever the outcome of these bills, whatever decision we take about the DSO, is to link the DSO as it currently exists or in some new form as part of the fight to deal with all forms of crime. You can't look at organized crime and corruption without locating it as part of the overall fight against crime and corruption. And clearly, too, whatever the intent of the executive, Parliament should actually look at the bills for what they are, look at the criminal justice system for what it is, and ensure that the one relates to the other. That, too, is an obligation. Even if we decide to keep the DSO, we have to integrate it as part of the new proposed integrated criminal justice system. So it works both ways. Having said that, I'm merely providing a framework within which we engage. This is not a full engagement around every little clause. You can make a statement of general nature, that's fine. We will have weeks upon weeks to deal with specific things. Steve Swap, who else wants to raise questions generally about what Advocate Simelane has just said? That's it. Okay, Steve.
Thank you, and I do hear about having an open mind. We appreciate that. But I do also share some of the concerns expressed by the previous speaker. But I would like to just specifically link this, my question, to the review of the criminal justice sector, and in particular the issue that is going to be the million-dollar question. The central question is the issue of the prosecutor-led investigations. Now, that came up very in the written papers. It came up that it is a necessity. It's linked. The Deputy Minister didn't refer specifically to it, but it is in the documentation, and that is a very important aspect and clearly something that we are going to lose in this bill that we deal with. But my direct question to the Director General is, during the Glenister application, it was very clear in the papers that the government gave an undertaking, and it's on affidavit, to retain the prosecution-led investigation method of the DSO. Wherever it is located, and that's a separate discussion. I would like to comment, the further statement that is on affidavit was that the use of multidisciplinary prosecution guided investigation teams will be incorporated into the new operational model. And that was at 30 April this year. And we clearly see the bills before us exclude the prosecutor-led model. And I'd like an explanation from Mr. Simelane, who made that affidavit on behalf of the ministers, as to why there's been that vast move that away from prosecutor-led driven investigations. Thank you.
So we have,
Just maybe before that, because, I mean, Mr. Swart's getting in.
into a lot of the detail. And what would be probably more useful, and also I think the issue of prosecutorial-led investigations or guided investigations, it's a bit of a, we don't want to get confused about it. I mean, as you know, the existing position with all other cases not dealt with by the DSO, is that the police investigate, they hand the docket to a prosecutor who then guides that investigation by calling for further evidence. What happened with the DSO was joining the two together, making them closer. You then have the problem of do the prosecutors get too deeply enmeshed in the case and lose their impartiality? But I think really, okay, you're walking out, but I think that the issue really, maybe before the DG responds, is maybe what we should do is get some kind of chart or outline of what happened before, okay, before the DSO amendment was passed in 2000. How did it work in terms of the relationship between prosecutors and investigators? What changes did the DSO amendment to the NPA Act make for those particular cases? And what then is the relationship going to be between prosecutors and investigators from now on if the bill is passed? So I just think let's look at it holistically. Let's not get confused by, with respect to SWAT, some terminology which may confuse. But that's going into the meat of the whole case. And I'm not sure if now is the right time. But I think further documentation from the Justice Department and SAPS would be useful in that regard. We've only just got the NPA submission now, and I note that they do have some elements of that, but it would maybe be useful to have a comprehensive document, an integrated document, not just from one or two strands of it.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I think my co-chair did indicate that after the public hearings, we will do some deliberations into the two legislations. I think it's where then we'll need additional information, where the Deputy Minister, Honorable Delange, and the ministers will be part of those deliberations in order for us then to accommodate exactly what we have just required from DG. I'll give over to you, DG, to respond on some of those questions in order for us to take the presentation from the police. Thank you.
I think the questions from honourable members, I think some of them would be clarified when the police have presented how this proposed structure is actually going to work. In the discussions that we had leading up to this, I just want to assure members that the issue of how best to structure the new unit, how it is going to operate, was discussed quite extensively. And there were different views and different approaches to it. And some of those discussions did look into what was identified as current challenges. Honourable Mr. Delport referred to them as defects. Indeed, some of the defects in the current framework. It was agreed and quite clearly that we need to have the new unit take some of the best models that we picked up from the way the DSO work. That's acceptable, that's accepted, without a doubt, that is precisely what is expected. At the same time, it is expected that some of the issues that have created challenges for us are going to be resolved by having this particular unit. The question that we debated extensively, which goes to Mr. Swart's question, was whether some of those issues should be expressed specifically in legislation or whether they will be by way of operational guidelines in the new unit once it is established. And we went back and forth a couple of times on this, and it was indicated that the preferred model is that this be not put down in legislation, because every time you're going to want to make a change, you'd need to amend legislation. So it's really a question of whether it is best to have everything that you want reflected in legislation or whether in the guidelines. And the approach taken was that because the environment is always fluid, there's always ongoing, you know, matters and the ongoing changes required from time to time, we will always have to come back to Parliament to amend legislation if you want to have any particular change. So the view was that let it not be put down in legislation, but let it be put in guidelines that the union should operate on. So the idea is correctly that the investigations will be driven by the particular units, but that the focus is that, and the term we used, we didn't use prosecution led, the term we used was that it must be court directed, because we wanted to make it clear that any purpose of investigation must have as its outcome a particular court process, so that we move away from the approach that says, you know, the police, once they've arrested, really a large part of their work has been done. We're trying to focus to say the point is that there must be a successful court outcome in the form of a prosecution before you measure any success. But all of those things were felt have to be reflected in the guidelines, but not in the specific legislation. To just move, deal with the points that we believe will arise in future when we have to make changes, then we have to come to Parliament. And we found that that's going to create actually a bottleneck for these very same units, that if you want it to be as effective as you want it to be, it can't, every time there's changes proposed to be made, to keep coming to Parliament. That largely was, in a way, I can call it sort of a philosophical difference in the discussion, to say where should the emphasis be. I think there are quite a number of, just to comment to the Honourable Mr. Delport's point around defect, there are quite a number of issues. I think I didn't give specific examples. I may have mentioned them just in broadly. The issue of coordination. I think the issue of coordination has been raised ad nauseum, that there is such difficulties, not always, and it's not correct, and I don't want to be, you know, in a way misquoted or to underrepresent issues. There is cooperation at various levels between the police and the DSO. So there are some levels where they work very well. But there are levels, particularly at the higher level, where they are not working particularly well. And that, we found, creates a lot more problems. So in weighing up some of the work that is being done very well and some of the work that is not being done very well, and we make an overall assessment, we found that the current environment does not lend itself to the type of environment that you'd like to see within the law enforcement environment. So that is a very serious defect, a material defect in our view, when we look at the way the two structures operate. There's been question raised about the manner in which, for example, things like intelligence information has been gathered, and we've raised very serious concerns about some of the type of work. There have been, you know, sound explanations given in law, in interpretation of laws, and so forth and so forth. But when you look at the, and you analyze issues from the ground, and you look at what actually is going on the ground, it's not the type of environment that should be left at law enforcement agency level, because those are guys that are operative on the ground, whether it's both the police or any other structure of the DSO, it doesn't really matter. From a policy perspective and from an executive perspective, you look at that environment and it's not a pleasing environment. You've got to therefore make appropriate changes to correct the situation, and it is the responsibility of the executive to do this. So that's another area where there is a very serious defect, as it were, based on our observations. So really, in a way, there are quite a number of examples that can be mentioned that have really given an indication that all is not well within our law enforcement authorities across the board. There's good on all sides that show that work is being done by committed people, but at the same time, there's an area of work about which we should be concerned and about which this Parliament actually should be concerned and better get into the details of, so that by the end of this process, as the co-chairs have said, there's at least all of the necessary information to enable members to know. Some of the information has been in the public domain. So I think, Honourable Depot, some of the defects have not all been mentioned yet, but you may have heard some of them mentioned in different fora, as it were. I mean, Habebo Commission being one, Chimala Commission being one, but some of those things are there. And, you know, the point that is being made, and again I want to be clear, the point that is being made is not that the DSO is useless. That's not the point that is being made. The point that is being made is that when we assess the work of our law enforcement agencies, it is not as effective as we'd want it to be. They are not cooperating with each other as they are expected to by the executive. There's not sufficient coordination as the executive expects them to. And on the basis of that, and, you know, amongst others, the public interest that gets undermined, the issue of national security that gets undermined inadvertently, you know, this particular proposal has been made. But I'd add, Chair, that maybe the the bills be presented, and then honourable members can ask questions, because it looks like they're asking questions without having had the benefits of the overall framework, and then we can respond to them. Thank you, Chair.
The delay would be to get to 1 o'clock, and then we'll break for lunch, to urge people who are here for the public hearings, you from civil society, not to worry. Two of the stakeholders have withdrawn for various reasons beyond their control, so there is plenty of time, and we will actually move things back. As a welcome advocate, I'm sure, MP, and Willie Hoffman, we'll move you back by about 45 minutes, but you have exactly the amount. There's no problem whatsoever. And we are very clear we're going to carry the public hearings over onto the 19th of August, and longer if we have to, and we'll sit through the early hours of the morning if we have to. So let's hand over to the... But the one thing we could ask the researchers to do already is to begin to identify all the issues that the department, the executive feels, are problematic with the DSO. Let's itemize them: duplication, conflict over turf, media leaks, use of intelligence services beyond what is provided for. They can start identifying that, because then we can look at, these are the problems, how do we deal with them? There will be differences of views. One is scrap it, one maybe fix it, and so on. The second issue that we cannot not identify immediately, and it's going to come up recurrently, is what is the role of prosecutors? Even if they are not attached to the unit directly, what would be their relationship with the investigators? That's the second theme that's already arising. But we should allow the public hearings to take place, because at the end of the public hearings, presumably, just as those who are supporting the Scorpions must keep an open mind, they might change their view. Just as those who are opposing the continued retention of the Scorpions might change their view. That's equally the case. So I think we don't want a full-blown exchange right now, but certainly the general theme should be highlighted as a framework to assist us in our exchange with the public when we go next week and so on. But Johan, over to you.
Thank you, Chair, very much. Yes, in view of everything that's been said so far this morning, I'm just very concerned that I might be boring this committee to death now, because I am dealing with a short poll with very straightforward provisions. The main focus of the bill is really to turn back the clock to where the National Prosecuting Authority Act was in 2000. Members will recall that it was in 2000 that the DSO provisions were inserted into the bill. And I hear that we're obviously going to get into the details of the legislation in the deliberative stages, but for those, I see many members who were involved in that process in 2000 as well. It makes very interesting reading to go back into the PMG minutes, and you will see how the themes are repeating themselves. And just to refresh members' memories, they will recall that the bill that was introduced, in fact, was a Directorate of Special Operations bill. It was introduced as a separate piece of legislation. It was only in the parliamentary process and Parliament exercising its prerogative that it was, in fact, made a part of the National Prosecuting Authority Act. And I'm just mentioning it because it really makes interesting, and you'll see the arguments that were followed at the time. And the concerns that are raised today are really very much the same concerns. But be that as it may, I'm sure we'll get into more detail. So I'll be very brief, but if members feel that I'm going too quickly, please stop me. But as I said, the bill is really very simple. And in order to start at the beginning, I'm going to have to start at the end of the bill, that is, and we get to the beginning of the National Prosecuting Authority Act, which is the preamble. If you look at clause 14 of the bill, you'll see that there are certain changes being made to the preamble of the National Prosecuting Authority Act. Those were the paragraphs that was inserted just to pave the way for the later introductions all relating to the establishment of the Directorate of Special Operations. Then clause 1 of the bill deals with definitions. All the definitions that are being changed relate to omitting references to the Directorate of Special Operations, references to specified offence, etc. Also omitting the definition of special investigator and deleting the reference to proclamations being issued for or in respect of the Directorate of Special Operations. Very small amendment in clause 2 once again. At the moment, Section 5 says that the Office of National Director of Public Prosecutions comprises, amongst others, special investigators. We're just removing that. That is the D, capital A, that's being removed there. Clause 3 is the investigating directorate provision. You'll see that we are deleting those provisions relating to the Directorate of Special Operations. An interesting or something noteworthy in this regard is members will note that it is only the DSO that's being removed in this regard. So the Act, Section 7, will still have room for investigating directorates to be established. Of course, if this legislation goes through, there will not be any investigating directorates, but the empowering clause would remain should a need arise. One noteworthy amendment in that regard would be that, I'm referring to subsection 2B, the proclamation establishing such an investigating directorate would be issued on the recommendation of the Minister for Justice, that is, as well as the Cabinet Member for Policing, which would also go some way to avoiding the kind of tensions and lack of coordination that we've had in certain instances in the past. Clause 4 is a small amendment to Section 11. It deals with the appointment of deputy national directors. Now, before the DSO was established, this section used to provide that the president may, after consultation with the minister and the national director, appoint not more than 3 persons as deputy national directors of public prosecutions. When the DSO legislation was imported, the decision was taken that it must be headed by a deputy national director of public prosecutions, which necessitated the changing the 3 to 4. Now we're just proposing remove the 4 and let the requirements at the time determine whether you need more than one and how many you need. It's the smallest thing. The next one is clause 5, Chair. Once again, it's section 13 being amended. It's just a reference in the MPA Act that says you may appoint one or more directors of public prosecutions to the Directorate of Special Operations. Obviously, it would become obsolete. Clause 6 repeals Chapter 3A of the Act. That's the chapter dealing with the appointment of special investigators, security screening of special investigators, and the conditions of service of special investigators. So all those provisions become obsolete and should be removed. Clause 7 deals with Section 23 of the Act. It's just repeating, they're just repealing subsection 2 there. Once again, referring to powers, duties, and functions of the Directorate of Special Operations. Clause 8, again, very consequential. It just deletes a reference to a proclamation in Section 7.1. That would have been a proclamation for the DSO. It's not required any longer. Clause 9 deletes the whole of Section 30. And 31, that is the powers and functions of special investigators, and Section 31, rather, the Ministerial Coordinating Committee. It's noteworthy that members will see when Dr. Jacobs and discuss the Police Service Amendment Bill that there is a similar kind of body envisaged in the Police Service, but that is the Coordinating Committee. Obviously, it's not required to be here anymore. Clause 10. Consequential amendments, once again, dealing with the budgetary provisions of the Directorate of Special Operations, the most important being that at the moment they have a CEO who is the accounting officer. Those provisions obviously also becoming obsolete. Clause 11 amends Section 40. Section 40 is the provision dealing with regulations. Section 42, the subsection being repealed, contained or is the empowering provision for all the regulations to be made in respect of the remuneration conditions of employment of the special investigators. Clause 12 is an amendment to one of the transitional provisions in the existing Act, which is becoming obsolete, as is Clause 13, also a transitional arrangement being repealed there. Chair, and that in a nutshell is it, and I think you can put it to the vote now.
Before Mr. Kronovald has not yet threatened me with constitutional court action. That was a facetious remark. Okay. Any questions, Steve?
Thank you, Chair. Can I just ask, you know, we've been speaking about relocation of the DSO to the SAPS, but if one reads this amendment very carefully, and I'm sure you'll be in agreement, by accepting this amendment, we will in fact disestablish the DSO, dissolve it, it will no longer exist. And so when we speak about relocating the DSO, it's actually incorrect. We've got to speak carefully about relocating only the investigators, because the DSO as a unit will no longer exist. We established it with that act, and we're now going to disestablish it if we pass that amendment act. We just have clarity on that. And then could you just touch on again, you said an investigative directorate will still exist. Under what conditions is that sought to, how would that operate? We just tie up with what I've just said. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yes, I think we need to bear in mind that it's not possible for us to write into the law the policy that's involved. But if you read the two bills together, you'll see, for example, that this National Prosecuting Authority Amendment Bill contains no transitional provisions whatsoever. No transitional provisions. But if you read the transitional provisions in the South African Police Service Amendment Bill, you'll see there you get the cross-referencing. And that's where you must remember that it's only the special investigators in the Directorate of Special Operations that are not, in terms of the Constitution, part of the National Prosecuting Authority. So it is that component that is being relocated to South African Police Services. Obviously, you cannot take members of the Prosecuting Authority who have a constitutional definition of the membership of that institution and then transfer them somewhere else. But those investigators have never been constitutionally members of the Prosecuting Authority. It is that capacity, that investigative capacity, that is being relocated. And the transitional arrangements in the SAPS Bill, I think, quite clearly spells out, in fact, it refers to them as being former members of the DSO, etc. So that is where your relocation comes in. Chair, sorry, Mr. Swart. Oh, yes, the investigative director, sorry. Yes, now, I might have been misunderstood. There will not be an investigating directorate left, but the empowering provision in terms of which investigating directorates are established for the National Prosecuting Authority, that remains intact. In other words, it would be possible, felt if the executive should feel the need to reinvent or to re-establish something like the Office for Serious Economic Offences, which previously was created as an investigating directorate when the National Prosecuting Authority Act was promulgated in 1998. So we're returning the empowering provision. So that's all I meant to say there.
I take it no more questions. It's now 1:57. How long will it take us to go through the other bills, you think? Is it going to be... Okay, yeah, let's go for it then. Yes, okay, so you take over.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think as a short background, I should just refer to the role of the South African Police Service in terms of the combating or the investigation of organized crime, as well as crimes requiring investigation on a national level. The reason why we are amending Section 16 of the South African Police Service Act is exactly because it addresses the issue of organized crime and crimes that need to be investigated on national level. It spells out the relationship between the provincial commissioners and the national commissioner in deciding on which cases need to be investigated on a national level. And firstly, we are amending Section 16 by inserting or adding to it the definition of serious offence as it is in the Interception Act, which broadens the scope of Section 16. Chairperson, honourable members, I should point out that I think it's sometimes forgotten that SAPS always had the responsibility in respect of the investigation of organised crime. Before the DSO was there, the SAPS investigated it. When the DSO was established, ever since, I think I can safely say that the bulk of organised crime and serious economic offences are being investigated throughout by the South African Police Service. Chair, I want to refer to the issue of the prosecution guided and prosecution led investigations before I start with the rest of the presentation. Actually, the principle referred to is the Troika approach, and that Troika does not only consist of SAPS or investigators and prosecutors, but investigators, prosecutors, and intelligence. And as we will see as I go through some of the observations of the COMPEPE Commission, we will see that the issue of intelligence was a real concern. Chair, further on the relationship with prosecutors. We had, I think, the issue of a Troika approach or the prosecution-guided investigations actually had its origin in the Office for Serious Economic Offences, where investigators looked at serious economic offences together with prosecutors, and that led to the Investigating Directorate for Serious Economic Offences, which was later absorbed into the Scorpions. Now, the need for the investigation of serious economic offences was so huge that the SAPS, again, had to create a unit, the Serious Economic Offences Unit, to address all the cases that are not being addressed by the DSO in respect of serious economic offences. And, Chair, the model that we see in that unit, where a serious economic offences court has been established and dedicated prosecutors are assigned to specific cases, that is the type of model that we really support from the police service side. And I must clearly say that we don't have any objection, and we feel the Troika approach, the approach of investigators and dedicated and assigned prosecutors to specific cases, especially high-level cases, is a very necessary one. At present, Chair, if we look at serious crime, whether it's organized crime or serious economic offenses, there normally is a need for the use of special investigative techniques. Now, these special investigative techniques involve undercover operations, entrapment, control deliveries, and surveillance. And in terms of Section 252A of the Criminal Procedure Act, investigators of the SAPS need to liaise with prosecutors to receive guidelines on how those undercover operations are being done. So I can safely say as well, with the investigation of organized crime by the South African Police Service, the issue of close cooperation and working together hand in glove with prosecutors is an accepted principle, and one that that is being adhered to at the moment already. But we say that it doesn't necessarily involve, as a result, that the prosecutor and the investigator need to be members of the same organization or institution. They can, as a matter of fact, if you look at the number of jurisdictions across the world, is that you will find a healthy division between the work of the prosecutor and that of an investigator. Chairperson, a lot was said about the integrated criminal justice system, etc. I just want to refer to the Gompepe Commission of Inquiry, and that might add to the list that the chairperson has mentioned that should be compiled of
the members have got a document. I think you're taking us through this one.
That's correct, sir.
The one that says, what does it say? A briefing on the SFCS for 5th August. So that's the one he's taking us through.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, the Gompepe Commission of Inquiry into the mandate and location of the Scorpions mentioned a number of issues that need to be looked at and which receive the attention of Cabinet and the decision makers. And some of them are the lack of coordinated relationships between the DSO and the South African Police Service and the intelligence structures. And remember what I said about the issue of the Troika principle, intelligence, investigation, and prosecution working together. The Commission pointed out a lack of oversight over the DSO by the Independent Complaints Directorate in respect of law enforcement functions. Now, the Independent Complaints Directorate is a separate institution under the Minister for Safety and Security, which is responsible for the investigation of criminal offences by members of the South African Police Service. Of course, the members of the DSO was not subject to that. A lack of oversight by the Inspector General of Intelligence in respect of intelligence activities. The non-compliance with vetting procedures in certain circumstances, liaisons by the DSO with foreign intelligence structures, the alleged leaking of information to the media, that the DSO had established crime intelligence gathering capabilities outside its mandate, and the disjunction in political accountability and oversight. In respect of the last point, disjunction, it refers, of course, to the functions of the Minister of Justice at the Minister for Safety and Security, the Minister of Justice being responsible for the justice matters, while the Minister for Safety and Security has the broad constitutional mandate in respect of crime and crime combating and investigation. Chair, I think we should also look at the State of the Nation debate, and it doesn't overlap with the quote that Deputy Minister De Lange made from that debate. The President announced the legislation before Parliament and emphasized what will continue to inform us as we take this step will be the absolute commitment of government to fight organized crime and to improve the management, efficiency and coordination of our law enforcement agencies. Of great importance, our success in the fight against crime depends on cooperation among all of us as law-abiding citizens, inspired by the principles of rule of law, respect for our judiciary and pursuit of equal human rights, which our Constitution enjoins us to observe in our daily lives and pronouncements. Chairperson, as Mr. De Lange has answered the question recently, now that the DSO investigative capacity is to be relocated to the South African Police Service. A new organized and priority crime combating capacity is to be established, and the new capacity is to consist of selected members of the SAPS and selected members of the DSO. Therefore, the bill proposes to establish the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation. That directorate will consist of selected members of the DSO, selected members of specifically the commercial crime component of the SAPS, selected members of the organized crime component of SAPS, and also other selected South African Police Service members. Chair, I need to add there, it's not in the presentation, but the bill further makes provision for the secondment of officials from other departments into the structure, as well as the appointment of persons who might be recruited in future into the structure. The bill provides for vetting of all members to be appointed into this directorate in accordance with the National Strategic Intelligence Act. The head of the directorate will be appointed by the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service. That head of the directorate will be on the level of a divisional commissioner, and the bill provides that that divisional commissioner will report to the deputy national commissioner responsible for crime detection and crime investigation, which will ensure coordination between the intelligence division and the directorate. Of course, the intelligence functions of that or intelligence support of the directorate will be from the crime intelligence division of the SAPS. A separate identity document will be issued to members to identify them as members of the directorate, and then the minister may establish a forum to promote cooperation with and coordination of functions of the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation and that of other governmental and public institutions. Chair, furthermore, the bill provides for powers similar to that of the DSO, the Investigating Directorates in the National Prosecuting Authority Act, for the head of the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation and the Crime Intelligence Division in respect of Section 16 offences. The provision we are referring to here is Section 28 of the National Prosecuting Authority Act, in terms of which a person may be summoned to appear before the head and is obliged to answer questions put to him or to provide documents, evidence, etc. required from that person. The provision in this bill differs to some extent in the sense that in terms of Section 28 of the NPA Act, persons are also obliged to answer incriminating questions, and that is not so in terms of the provision proposed in the bill. Chair, there are already similar provisions which involve police officers. If we look at Section 22 of the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorist and Related Activities Act, as well as Section 22 of the Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, there is a similar provision in terms of which police officers may be designated to perform functions in terms of Chapter 5 of the National Prosecuting Authority Act. The only difference there as well is that in the both two acts that I've mentioned, the National Prosecuting Authority must be approached, and the National Prosecuting Authority will designate a Director of Public Prosecutions to assist with that process. Chair, the same power is proposed for the Head of Crime Intelligence, along with the Head of the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation. And this flows from a recommendation of the Gompepe Commission, and it was actually a proposal that the South African Police Service made to the Gompepe Commission that we require that type of power in terms of police investigations where the same type of crime is being investigated by the South African Police Service. Of course, in this case, those provisions will be limited to the Directorate and Crime Intelligence only. Chair, furthermore, the bill proposes that a budget for the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation shall be defrayed from monies appropriated by Parliament, and the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service will be the accounting officer. That, of course, doesn't mean that it will stand totally separate from the budget of the police service. It will form part of the bigger safety and security budget, but this will be a separate program, as is administration and detectives, etc. Chair, then, as Mr. De Lange has mentioned, that the transitional provisions providing for the transition and the process is in this bill, and it proposes that from a specified date, all powers and functions of the DSNO investigators shall be exercised under the control of the National Commissioner. Now, the specified date is a date that will be determined by the President. It provides that all special investigators of the DSO will become members of SAPS on the specified date with the retention of their conditions of service and service benefits. DSO investigators placed with the DPCI, we assume that some of them might have been involved in crime intelligence or intelligence activities, and there's a possibility that some of them may, for example, be placed in crime intelligence. Of course, DSO personnel who do not want to be relocated to SAPS must indicate so before the specified date. The bill says that they retain the right to resign if they so want. Of course, this does not mean that they cannot be redeployed in the NPA as well. The bill specifically provides that for the continued validity of investigations as well as prosecutions that the DSO is currently involved in, and the bill provides for the transfer in terms of the PFMA Act of all budgets and assets of the DSO on the specified date to the SAPS budget. Chair, of course, this bill must be read in conjunction with the NPA bill that has been presented already. And I think an issue that is very important in terms of the transition is one of audits, and that includes audits of personnel, budget assets, liabilities of the DSO, concurrent with the legislative process. And there, Chair, and that is not in the bill, but on an administrative level, there should be audit committees, steering committee and audit committees, which will look at communications, change management, joint task teams to audit and manage cases and investigations, contracts and agreements, information and communication systems technology, policy and procedures, personnel, physical assets, and finance and budget issues. And then, Chair, lastly, on the financial implications of the bill, until those audit processes have been done, it is actually impossible to calculate the actual cost for the transfer. And as it is being pointed out in the object memorandum as well, that we of course will need to look at the issue of disparity of salaries of SAPS members that will be placed into the new directorate, as well as the present salaries of the members of the DSO placed into that. That in a nutshell, Chair, a summary of both. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner Jacobs. The time is now 1:10. I'm sure that members did note for questions or clarities or anything that they would like to ask the police. We'll deal with that when we come back from lunch. We'll come back at 2:10, exactly 1 hour. The lunch will be served in old assembly at dining hall. Members know where it is, and then we just follow members of parliament. Thank you very much. We'll start again at 10 past 2.
Just the one other thing is, if it does, Helen Suzman Foundation...